Come together now. Come together now. Africans of the diaspora, Africans on the continent, I say, come together now. Come together now. They sing and rap, and I feel myself caught up in the beat, all goose pimply and possessed. And they are pumping their hands in the air, a sea of bobbing heads bouncing to the beat. And I'm unselfconsciously bobbing right there with them. I closed my eyes and was transported in time to the 60s. I see us in dashikis and bell-bottom pants, carved wooden fists on gold chains around our necks. I feel the wooden floor sway and shiver as 100 feet respond to James Brown shouts of, say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud. And then an unbridled well bursts through my consciousness, tugging me back to the here and to the now. I shake my head and flow into the night of that hip-hop beat. I look around me and see no bright bordered dashikis but the red and black robes of the Messiah. I see beadwork and conga cloth wrapped round the necks and shoulders of young black men and young black women. I see beaded braids and locks and shaven heads and hats embroidered with cowrie shells and paint. I hear shouts of pride in Kisukuma, Kiswahili, Kichaga, Kimeru, Kingereza, and even French. It feels like a church meeting, y'all. A blues hall, a Panther PE meeting wrapped all in one. And I suddenly feel like I'm gonna cry or grin or do both with the absolute wonder of it all. I squeeze Pete's shoulder hard as our emotions meet in complete agreement. We thrust our chins out in the defiant stance of bygone days, and I can tell he is thinking the same thing that implodes my mind. That Panther spirit ain't dead, no way. It just moved round the corner, crossed the ocean, and is still well and very much alive right here in an East African village.
Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, the Black Arts and Culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. And that was Mama C doing one of her famous poems. That particular one is, you know, one that sort of went viral. That Panther spirit is alive and well in East Africa. Good morning and welcome to the show. So happy that you're able to join us.
Good morning. I'm happy to be here. I'm always happy to talk to you and your listeners, sister.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. And you are just moving all around the country. So happy that you always put the San Francisco Bay Area in your itinerary when you come to town from Tanzania. I'm speaking to Charlotte Hill O'Neill, also known as Mama C. She's an internationally known visual artist, musician, and poet of more than two decades of experience. She was born in Kansas City, Kansas, in 1951 and has lived in Africa with her husband, Pete O'Neill, since 1970. She is a mother of two children, Malcolm and Ann Wood, or Stormy. She is co-director of the United African Alliance Community Center, UAACC, located outside Arusha, Tanzania. And that website is uaacc.habari.co.tz. So go visit that website and see what they're up to. Mama C was greatly influenced in her early years by the jazz, blues, and gospel that Kansas City is famous for, and integrates elements of that experience in both her music and rhythm of her poetry, along with the African beats and hip-hop vibe of her spirit. And I want her to jump right into talking about this new film, and she's got a new book, too. Her first book, or the more recent book, was in 2008, Warrior Woman of Peace, which is really phenomenal. And the next book, which is out this year, is it already out?
It's not out. It'll be out, though, at the end of the year, Life Slices.
A Taste of My Heaven. It's like, ooh, that sounds lovely.
Yes, and I'm also working on my autobiography. So, yes, I'm real excited about that also.
And you're a quilting artist, and you all have a children's home there. That's the most recent project, right?
Yes, that's right. The Leaders of Tomorrow Children's Home. My husband actually established that almost 4 years ago, and we're raising 22 beautiful, smart children. Some of them are come from really destitute backgrounds, and some of them are orphans, but all of them are smart, sister, and creative, and respectful, and such a good example to all children and adults, too.
Wow, that's awesome. And so tell us about this film that you are also being featured in, that's going to be premiering at the Pan-African Film Festival tomorrow, the 16th, right?
That's right. The 17th at 7:30 it will be screening, and then also it will be screening on Sunday at, I think, around 12 noon. But I will be there tomorrow, and the director, Dr. Joanne Hirschfield, who is the head of Women's Studies Department at North Carolina State Chapel Hill. She'll be there also, and we'll conduct Q&A after the screening. It's called Mama C, Urban Warrior in the African Bush, and it focuses on my life as an artist activist. And she did a good job, I must say. It includes some of my poetry. It includes some of our history. And it's a nice film, and I hope many people come out to see it.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure a lot of people are going to be coming out to see it. And you were able to screen that film here in Oakland at Laney College. What was that? Was that last night or Wednesday night?
That was Wednesday night, and it was an excellent reception. It was also screened privately at in South Carolina, Columbia, South Carolina, at the Black Picks, Real Black Picks Film Festival. And you know, I also visited Merritt College, and I'm telling you, sister, that those students there just made me feel almost like crying with happiness. It was just such a beautiful thing. They had performances from the Ile Omode
group.
Oh, my goodness. And, you know, all of my Northern California Bay Area tour is organized by It's About Time, BPP. And your listeners can go on their website to learn more history of the Black Panther Party. So I give thanks to Sister Gail Shawn and Brother Bill Jennings for always doing such an excellent job in organizing this part of my journey.
And your tours are always called Heal the Community Tour. And I was wondering if you could talk about that and in light of the work that you're doing in Tanzania with Brother Pete.
Yes, the Heal Community a program was actually started in 1994, and it started with a climb to the top of Mount Kilimanjaro by my husband, Pete O'Neill, to demonstrate how with determination, with focus, you can do anything in life. So when we first had our exchange programs with youth from Kansas City who would come to the center, to our village, Brother Pete would always take them up the mountain, you know, and it really enforced the fact that unity is what makes things happen, and focus, you know, and determination. So we named it Heal the Community because we feel that the work that we do, the history that we come out of, is so inspiring to so many people that it can add an element to the healing of our communities. This is one of the things that I really, really enjoy doing, is going to different college campuses and community centers and churches and mosques and wherever people want to hear me share about the work that we're doing, because inevitably people are inspired by that and want to do the same thing in their communities, or even come out and volunteer at UAACC. There are many opportunities to do that. So it's hard work, sister, to tour for 3 months, you know, but it's something that I absolutely love.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about your travels. You just recently had an artist residency in Egypt, and there was a Nile River project in October, I guess, of last year that's connected to that. And
actually, that project was rescheduled.
Oh, okay.
That project has been rescheduled, but I am going to Ghana next month. At the invitation of the French Cultural Center. I'll be there performing and speaking for 2 weeks, and this is my first time in West Africa, so I am so excited about that, and I'm a little apprehensive too, because, you know, the ancestors speak to me so strongly, and for me to go in those dungeons, you know, that is going to be a real ordeal for me. You know, it really is, as it is for all Africans of the diaspora. But I'm a little apprehensive about it, but I know that I'm strong and I can do it, and I know the ancestors keep me lifted up. I've also been invited for a 2-month residency in Shanghai, China, from September to October, and this is the Association of Shanghai Writers, and I will be going there as a poet. So that's my first time to China too, and of course during the Heal the Community tour, I'll be going just about everywhere from California. I'll go to Texas, then I'll go to New York, then to China, and then to Ghana. And then back, I'll start the tour again until the end of April. I plan to come back to L.A. also the second week of April, and I'll be in Seattle the first week. So it's going to be busy, and then when I go back home, I'll hit the ground running, because we have a really, really innovative project there that I'd love to tell you about.
Oh, yeah, please do.
Okay. You know, in so many cultures in Africa now, because of the encroachment of Western cultural values that is spreading more and more, we're trying to counteract that, and we're trying to counteract it through our music, through our art in general. So I have gotten together with several musicians, and we're building traditional indigenous instruments, learning to play them, and teaching people to play them. And we have started working on a indigenous music museum, and it's scheduled to open during our annual African Liberation Day celebration in May. I think it's May 24th. So I have been learning to play African lyre, L-Y-R-E, that is called the obokano. And the obokano was actually taboo for women to play, and I have been honored to be the first woman to play it, you know. So there's a sister from South Africa who plays the Obokoyane. She's taught us how to play that. That's similar to the birimbam that they play during the capoeira.
Okay.
You know that? Yes, yes. And then there's several other instruments. And
yeah,
that is an exciting project. And
yeah.
We've been playing all over Tanzania,
mm-hmm.
and we expect to play in other countries too. So I'm ready for that. I tell you, I might rest a couple of days when I get back, and then I'm off again. And our children, several of our children, have learned to play it. And I mean, they're good already.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Oh, wow. That is really, really awesome. You just, wow, wow. So you're just moving around and traveling. When do you have time to do this writing, you know, writing your poetry, you know, this
yes.
book that's coming out and your autobiography? And
well, I tell you, I don't sleep much.
Mm-hmm.
I do not sleep much. I got too much to do. And I'm going to celebrate my 62nd birthday while I'm in Ghana. So that's a double blessing. Yeah.
Yeah, I was at your 60th birthday party with Gail.
Yeah.
And some other friends in Sacramento. That was fun. It was a pouring day, but, you know, once we got inside the community center, it was just lovely.
That's right. Yeah, Sister Gail is my Pisces sister.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Neat. Yeah. So talk a bit. I've been really curious about sort of the way art is really integral to the human making process. I mean, you know, people think that okay, you're born in this form and you, it's a given that you're human, but it's not a given. We have to work on that. So
that's
I wonder
right.
if you could talk about how you know your art practice because you. You know, you're multi-disciplinary insofar as, I mean, you write and you quilt and you do all kinds of art. You visual art, you do music, you know, you play instruments. You know, you just sort of like, I think, I don't know if there are any genres within the art form that you haven't perhaps tackled and mastered. And so you're just sort of, you know, doing a whole lot of art. And then you also share that. In your organization with young people, and you provide the forum so that young people can make their art and do their art and work through certain things that might be hard, but then the end result is beauty.
That's true, and you know that's really one of my passions, and that's one of the reasons I feel that I'm on the planet in this lifetime is to spread the word of the importance of everyone exploring their creativity. You know, because recognizing your artistic nature is something that helps you blossom. No matter if you're a mathematician or a scientist or a doctor or whatever you are, you must explore that side of you because that is really what brings out our humanity and that's what causes us to feel a sense of unity with other people on the planet. You know how you always hear how music really has no language, art really has no language, or you know, it's the thing that unifies us. It's the thing that gives us confidence. And time again, I've seen young people from the village and even from town come to the center, and when they come there, they're all shy and almost withdrawn, you know, and kind of scared. And once they start exploring their art, they just thoroughly blossom and they walk with a straight back and their confidence overflows. One thing that is also one of my passions is to work with the hip-hop artists in our community. And we have many summits and different workshops with visiting artists, and we sit down and make sure that we keep hip-hop relevant to the community and use it as a teaching tool, you know. So, of course, you have your hip-hop artists who try to imitate a lot of the negativity that's coming out of the West that you see on the TV, you know, but you have a strong movement of artists who are really using hip-hop in the manner that it was supposed to be used, the way it was originally used. You know, I love it when artists from the States and other places come there and share with our artists there in East Africa. It's always a brilliant meeting of minds and creativity, and plus the fact that we have a recording studio there makes it even better. You know, so yeah, I'm on a mission to make sure that everyone understands and explores their creativity. It's so important.
Mhm. Yeah, and let's see, the film that Niwakani sort of looks at that.
Yes, mm-hmm. Niwakati. Yes, that means it's time. And that's when M1 of Dead Prez came with Umi, came of RBG Productions. That's when they came to East Africa and they came to the center. And Brother Michael Wanguhu and Russell Kenya, they made a documentary about that. They're also the filmmakers who did Hip Hop Colony, which explores the history of hip-hop in East Africa. Yes, you know, as a member of the Black Panther Party, we were always taught that art shouldn't be used just art for art's sake. It should always be a tool to educate and enlighten the community, you know. So that's the message that we constantly try to pass on. If you look at our walls at the center, they have so many beautiful examples of positive graffiti on there. Each wall has a beautiful message, you know. And, you know, we as African people, we've always related to art, you know, even in the way we adorn ourselves, in the way we carry ourselves, you know. So that's something that's just in our blood. And not only in the African community, it's in everybody, you know.
Yeah. But we set the precedent.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Hey.
Yeah. I was
and you know, I'm sorry. No, no. You said what?
I was just thinking when you were talking about art being, you know, having use and or utilitarian, and art having a message. I was just thinking about Richard Wright and James Baldwin, their conversation. I believe it was the two of them that had a conversation around that. I think the writers met in Europe. I'm not certain if it was Paris. And they were talking about, and I think Zora Neale Hurston was there too. And I think they were talking about maybe even Langston Hughes. I think it was Langston Hughes and Richard Wright. Yeah, it was. It was Langston Hughes and Richard Wright. And they were talking about sort of the, you know, the black artist and his or her duty to the community. And I believe Richard Wright was talking about how there was just too much work in our community to be writing about roses. And how the tree grows. And then I think, if I'm remembering the writer correctly, I think it might have been Langston Hughes. And he didn't necessarily agree. And I, you know, I'm of the mind that If the artist is being honest and truthful in their portrayal, the audience will get the message, and you don't have to necessarily hit the person over the head with it.
Right, that's right. And these days we actually do, I think, need to write about the roses and the trees because of the degradation of the environment. You know, we need to let the youth know that, hey, you better plant some food on that empty parking lot, and you need to get together with your community to start community gardens and to grow trees. You know, we actually, times have changed, and we do need to teach our children about protecting the environment, you know. So if people can do that through their poetry or through their music or however they can do it through their art, I think it adds to the education of our communities worldwide.
Yeah. I wonder if you could talk a bit about, you know, what it's like in Tanzania. I know the president of Tanzania, he was just so wonderful in that he invited Africans in the diaspora to come live there.
This was
around the time of the civil rights movement toward the end of it. And you know, we have the veterans of the civil rights movement, the person who founded the Africa, the Algebra Project, he went there to sort of recuperate and regenerate himself. I'm drawing a blank on his name. You probably know it. He's still with us. I think he went and he took his children, and they lived in Tanzania for a while. But I was just wondering if you talk a bit about, you know, why you chose Tanzania in particular, and what it's like there. Some of our audience probably haven't been to Africa, East Africa in particular. And then another thing was, there is a legacy of enslavement in East Africa, and I was wondering, you mentioned about the dungeons in West Africa, and you know, and you said you talked to your ancestors, and I'm wondering about the dungeons in East Africa. And what the ancestors were telling you when you went there. So there's like about three things in that one question.
Well, I can start with the beauty of Tanzania, you know, both the beauty of the people, the beauty of the whole peaceful vibe there, you know. It is just, and the hard working people and the camaraderie, you know, when we came there in the 70s, it was still at the height of President Nyerere's socialist movement, you know, and I can remember actually seeing adults sitting under the trees learning how to read, you know, and everybody working the land. It was a lot of hard work going on. You know, there's a different administration there now, and it's more of a government that's built more on kind of Western examples, you know, but there's still the old guard there. There's still a thread of socialism running through the whole society there, you know. The weather is beautiful. We live on the foothills of Mount Meru, which is the third tallest mountain in Africa, and right in sight of Mount Kilimanjaro, actually 30 miles as the crow flies, you know. So being at a high altitude like that, it stays pretty cool, you know. We live in a farming community. We live in a village called Mbasani, and it's almost sometimes it seems like a surreal experience of living, even though we've been there for like almost 40, we've been there 33 years in this particular village. And when I wake up every morning, it still seems like a dream, you know, because it's so beautiful. Can you imagine waking up to the cacophonous sounds of, I don't know how many species of birds who always come there, all the trees that we actually planted with our own hands. You know, we were homesteaders for many, many years before we actually formally started the community center. So we have a lot of experience in growing our own food and raising our animals and this and that. We don't raise animals now, though. So it's an ideal lifestyle. But many people, I think, have a real romanticized view of what it is like to live in the countries of Africa, and think that there'll be honey from the bees and fruit from the trees will just flow and fall down without them actually working hard. You gotta work hard, you know? And we've done this for so many years, and now, you know, we don't have to till the land ourselves. We've gotten kind of old, you know. Mm-hmm. So we have young people who are following in our footsteps. We have Sister Mwajabu, who's been with us since she was 14, who is both our right and left hand, you know, and many brothers and sisters who, excuse me, who are primed to take over from us when we're too old to do this work. Brother Pete will be 73 this year, and like I said, I'll
be
62. Yes, I'm still a baby, actually, but, but, you know, it's good that we have youth who'll be able to step into our shoes and take over. I invite your listeners to come and check it out for themselves. I invite you, my sister, to come to UAACC, the United African Alliance Community Center, and check it out. And be prepared to roll up your sleeves and share the knowledge that you have.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I am so looking forward to it.
Good.
Yeah.
You're going to love it. A lot of people come, they don't eat, and they stay. So you better watch out.
Oh, hey, you know, I would love to live in Africa with you all for a year. That'd be really wonderful.
Let's do it.
Mhm. Okay. Well, you sent me a couple of your poems, Mama is Free and Journey to, how do you pronounce that?
Lingai.
Lingai.
Lingai, yes. That's actually our latest effort of Wakunga Zamani. This is the group I was telling you about that we have now who focuses on indigenous music. And Wakunga Zamani means ancient midwives. And even though some of the group are brothers or men, we still consider all of ourselves to be midwives, giving birth to a new way of thinking about ancient traditions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'll play that after my next interview because my other guest is in the studio. But in closing, I wanted to ask you, you know, for some comments. And on yesterday was a day that Eve Ensler has called us to look at violence against women and girls, and she calls it V-Day based on her vagina monologues. And yesterday she did a call for 1 billion rising. All around the world, she called for, you know, people to look at ending violence against women and girls throughout the world. And so people were, like, dancing and celebrating life. Even people who were incarcerated, people were dancing at San Quentin, and they were dancing at San Bruno Jail, and we were dancing in San Francisco and in Oakland, and I saw videos of people dancing in Nepal and other places in the world. And then last night I went to an event at the First Presbyterian Church in Oakland, and that was fun. It ended in a dancing thing. It was really fun.
Yeah.
So I was wondering if you could maybe, since, you know, your whole thing is around healing our community, and we talked about that initially, you know, all of your tours are called Heal the Community Tours.
Yeah.
I wanted you to talk about, you know, the whole thing around, you know, ending violence against women. There's some traditions that our communities have inherited that are not healthy. You know, whether that's, you know, female circumcision, or that's drinking and using drugs, or being unkind to one another intentionally and things like that. So I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit.
Well, we've actually addressed that many times, and I don't know if you've heard of Maya Cizena. She is an integral part of that movement of stopping violence against women, and we have the blessing of her coming to Arusha and helping us to host a workshop, a big workshop on addressing that issue. And it was the most touching thing, the fact that brothers got up in that meeting and were telling us the different atrocities that their sisters or their mothers had gone through. And I mean, we had brothers crying, sisters, and how they want to make sure that the youth, the young men, understand the necessity of stopping violence toward their sisters, you know. It was just a beautiful, heartfelt time. So this is an ongoing thing. If I had been home in Arusha, we would have been dancing also, you know, celebrating life, celebrating the solidarity that women and men across the planet, you know, the fact that they're addressing this issue of violence against women. So Yeah, Maya Azucena has this. She was actually a victim of domestic violence for 7 years, and nobody knew it. You know, so she has this video called "Lines in My Skin" because her boyfriend would like put these little cuts on her. Mm-hmm. You know, and she's made a new video also for this. What's it called? 1 million.
One billion rising.
Yeah, she's a part of that. So, her name is Maya Azucena.
How do you spell
that? So y'all check her out, too. And I think if we stand strong and be an example, you know, to our brothers and sisters and let them know that, you know, we're spreading the love, we can obliterate that.
Mm-hmm. Right. How do you spell her name?
Maya, M-A-Y-A, Azucena, Azucena. She's a brilliant artist, a Grammy Award winning artist, actually. She did a song with Stephen Marley that won a Grammy. She travels all over the world. And she'll be in Tanzania, I think, in March as a part of International Women's Month.
Oh, maybe I can talk to you all when you're there.
Well, I'm not going to be there. I'm going to be in Ghana.
Maybe you can connect us. But I would love to talk to you after you get back from Ghana about your trip there. That'd be interesting. Yeah.
That would be beautiful. I look forward to it.
Yeah, and I look forward to seeing you this summer on your soil.
Yes.
That's going to be awesome. Well, thank you so much, Mama C, for dropping by to visit us. And have fun in Los Angeles. And looking forward
thank
to seeing you when you come back to the West Coast.
Okay, sister. I always enjoy talking to you and to your listeners.
I enjoy and love talking to you, too. And continue with all the wonderful work. And good luck on all the writing projects and on your music, your new musical career.
Thank you so much. Okay.
So you are. Peace and blessings.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Good morning, Pastor Leslie White. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you so much for joining us to talk about this wonderful Voice of Healing concert. It sounds like it's going to just be fantastic. And it's the second annual. I didn't know about the first one, but I'm so happy that Terry told me about it and I haven't missed it.
Well, I'm so glad that you, first, it's great to meet you over the air. And I'm so thankful for your willingness to share and allow us to promote it even better. Last year was the first year, and I'm sorry we didn't get it out to you, which we're trying to do better, and by your very activity of embracing us to talk about it, I'm sure many others will know about it who did not know last year.
Oh, thank you. So, Pastor White, you're the senior pastor at St. Paul African Methodist Episcopal Church in Berkeley, and you are also responsible, and that church is located at 2420 Ashby Avenue, and the concert is actually going to be happening there as well on February 24th. I want to make sure I get that information out there. February 24th at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and it's a free concert, but love donations are going to be accepted and definitely encouraged.
Yeah, that's correct.
Because it's a fundraiser for some organizations that you support, right?
Right. What we are doing is a benefit concert consisting of Berkeley High School Jazz Band, the Oakland Bay Area Community Choir, the Oakland Youth Chorus, and the University of California Berkeley Gospel Choir. And this is to benefit humanitarian efforts in the fight against AIDS and hunger relief, education in the Virgin Islands, Dominican Republic, Haiti, Jamaica, and on the mother continent of Africa. And so we are asking persons first to come and receive the blessings of these excellent, excellent groups that have consented to be a part of this effort. and then we ask for a $20 donation if they are so led to benefit others, because as you know, the American dollar multiplies when it goes to these other nations, and $1 can be worth as much as $33 depending upon the nation that it goes to. So our gift of $20 can almost add up to $1,000 depending upon which country, you know, that particular dollar will end up. And it does make such a difference in the lives of people that we don't know but yet are blessed by our generosity.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. Yeah, and you've been doing a whole lot of, work in the community. You're responsible for organizing Berkeley's first Martin Luther King Jr. Celebration Breakfast. That was last year and this year. Mm-hmm. And this year included our Berkeley Police Department. I guess they were there at the breakfast, the mayor, and many other city officials and community groups. I want you to talk about that a little bit. And then you also started Berkeley's first gospel jazz services 2 years ago, and yeah. And it happens every fifth Sunday. So there's no fifth Sunday in February, so I guess you're having this concert.
Yeah, that's right. That's pretty good. We are, I am so blessed to be a part of a magnificent team of Berkeley community citizens, stakeholders who have come together over these last really 3 years in the working, two celebrations have occurred for the Martin Luther King Jr. celebration. It has always consisted of the police department, Police Chief Michael Meehan, the University of California, Berkeley, with Linda Williams, many of the pastors of the community, the downtown Berkeley Community Organization with John Kaner, Berkeley Chamber of Commerce, the Berkeley Organizing Congregations for Action, BOCA. It is just an excellent group of people who are like-minded in the mission and purpose that Martin Luther King also embraced and espoused, which is the beloved community. We began last year with our first celebration. And we were at the Shattuck Hotel in downtown Berkeley, and it overflowed. And then we said, let's move to a bigger venue. And so we went to the Doubletree and the Berkeley Marina, and again, overflowed. And by that, I mean the first year, I think the Shattuck could hold in the neighborhood of 200-plus people, and we were field there, and then the Berkeley Marina Doubletree could hold 400, and we were field there. We had the blessing this year of President Barack Obama's inaugural celebration, so we streamed it in live, and people there at the celebration acted like they were right there in Washington, D.C., shouting and crying and singing and clapping. I mean, it was just one of those moments in time when the community is a community, you know. And we celebrated two young people from our community, from the Martin Luther King Jr. Elementary School. And their work was published in the Oakland Tribune through the leadership of the Reverend Byron Williams in a column a couple of weeks ago. And they wrote magnificent poems. They drew art depicting Dr. King and his work in the movement for human rights. These young people are just magnificent, and we are so proud of them. And we were able to support Sister Small of the Berkeley Alliance and giving her an award for the work she has done in this community. So it is just a fabulous event. I don't want to, you know, just but I'm just so proud of this committee. It's no way in the world that I am, you know, responsible. I'm just a mere part of it. And they are so excellent to give of their time and effort. The gospel jazz, you know, part of the fact of American, of a life in America for the African and African descendants has been the creation of certain music genre, thus gospel music, jazz music, rhythm and blues, hip-hop. So, and as always, they have a religious or a spiritual base and origin, and obviously they come through the church. They are by church people, or if a church song is not taken and put into rhythm and blues or jazz or hip hop, then we take a song from those genres and bring them back into sacred music. So let's, you know, it's just an honest effort to say let's be inclusive of all music that is unique for us as African Americans, and for all people. You know, just because it's African American music doesn't mean it's, you know, not loved by everybody.
It is loved by everybody.
That's right. And so we, on our fifth Sundays, we have a different artist in, and the Berklee High School Jazz Band, Derek Hughes, Rhonda Benham have all been here, and so many others. And just the way that we're able, the University of California, Berklee Gospel Choir came once, and we've been able to weave a worship service inclusive of the music, the Word of God, the prayers, the scriptures, all of that, that touches everybody. And it's just a phenomenal kind of an experience, and with the magnificent turnout. And we just continue to push it. Hopefully this summer we can do a day-long event on a fifth Sunday during the summer that, you know, gets in more groups and kind of push the envelope even further as it relates to our inclusiveness of really how God expresses himself in areas, if I dare say, where the church sometimes doesn't want to go. But God still goes. God still lays his hands on people, and he still communicates his message of love and redemption unto them. And so, you know, I'm all for what God is doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so are we. Just think about Nancy Wilson and how there was a little resistance in the church community to her singing, and she didn't see any difference between what she was singing, you know, in the secular world and what she had been singing in church, because it was, you know, all about the same, you know, kind of topic. I mean, she was still talking about, you know, sort of lifting up the goodness that is within all of us. And and so, you know, eventually I think people kind of caught on. I guess similarly with Ray Charles, when he took,
right,
you know, the gospel form and put it on sort of, I guess, R&B, and just really sort of changed that music in a really, you know, fantastic way.
Right.
I was thinking about, I want to let our audience know that you, you're from the Pacific Northwest, and you went to school there, and then you headed south to the historic black colleges.
Right, yes.
Morris Brown in Atlanta, Georgia, and
yes,
you stayed down there. You went to the Turner Theological Seminary, and,
yes,
and then you came back to the Pacific, on this time the southern part of the West Coast,
mm-hmm,
where you went to Claremont,
right,
the School of Theology. And you got a doctorate of philosophy there. And I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about your journey. And then I wanted you to go back and just, for those listeners who are not quite familiar with what Martin King meant about the beloved community, you know, on the, what is it, the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington and his I Have a Dream speech. And next week there's going to be this great film on Whitney Young called Power Broker, and that's going to be on the 18th. And I had a really wonderful conversation with his niece, Bonnie Boswell. So I just wanted to sort of like give us a little background here about your journey, and then you can go into details about what I just mentioned, if you remember it. Otherwise, you can ask me to repeat it.
Please don't let me monotone along, so break me up. But I want to begin with Whitney Young, just a brief moment. Mm-hmm. I have a copy of his book on race relations that he wrote immediately after he helped Israel and the Arab nation to form Israel as a state back in 1947-48, because he was the one that helped to negotiate that reality.
Mm.
And the book I have has his actual handwriting in it, where he wrote that book kind of in a moment of crystallization about, you know, what it would take for us to be more of a community on an international level. But it's just phenomenal, the mind and heart and determination that he had. So I definitely look forward to that movie. My own journey is so blessed to be seated with some of the best people God has put on this earth. First, my parents are, if I could say, American immigrants, if that makes sense, mm-hmm. from the South to the Northwest. My father from Savannah, Georgia, and my mother from Paris, Texas. And they actually met in Portland, Oregon, but they had already, because of my father's case, he was in the Army and was stationed or moved out of Fort Vancouver in that area, in that era of time in the 40s. And my mother, her oldest sister, was married to a man that was in the Army, and they came back to Portland. So she initially left Paris, Texas, and spent 2 years here in San Francisco area. And then she moved on up to Portland, and that's where my parents met. They were already, my father was a member of the First Bryan Baptist Church in Savannah, Georgia, and my mother was a holiness. But when they came together as a married couple, they decided to give up their respective denominational affiliation and became African Methodist. Mm-hmm. And a member of the African Methodist Church, Bethel AME, there in Portland. When I had some magnificent mentors, Alfred Lee Henderson and Ellis H. Kasson, as pastors and associate pastors, and they were always involved in the life of the community. They saw ministry, and I think it's so limiting to say social gospel, but they saw the gospel, the parish of the gospel, to be within the walls and beyond the walls of the particular church location. And so I came up with that. I came up with my mother being involved in the Boy Scouts and the Cub Scouts and the March of Dimes and UNICEF. And so that's kind of the community I was raised in. But more particular, it was the people that I was around that just seeded in me over the years that's how life is supposed to be, that you're supposed to make life better for self, but make life better for others. And that was never a creative tension, you know, who first, me or others. It was what you do, you know, and that if you're making life better for others, you're making life better for yourself. Then as I was called by God into this ministry, I wanted a more African-American experience. And so though I had gotten scholarships to the University of Oregon and Oregon State University in math, and the engineering program, that's a whole nother story. I didn't, you know, I wanted to go to an African-American college. And so Morris Brown in Atlanta was the chosen school, not really because of Atlanta, but more so because of Morris Brown. It offered the kind of program that I was interested in, which was psychology. Mm-hmm. And But my goodness, going to Atlanta in 1973, there were still many of the vestiges of, segregation, Jim Crow era. And so to go through downtown Atlanta and the Woolworths and I think it was S.H. Crest and other stores where they had the lunch counters where the wall was just kind of taped up or covered over where the hole was, where they used to hand out food to black people, to see in, where the fixtures were still side by side, but the signs were taken down, but, the plumbing was still there and operating, because it was just 5 years after the death of King, and in many instances, those stores, they took down the signs, but they didn't get rid of the way in which they had built the building that was, lent itself towards segregation. I don't even believe Dr. King's crypt had yet been put. It may have, but I don't believe it was yet put where it is. I think he was still at the Westview Cemetery. So Morris Brown became just a big experience in my life, a transitional, a transformative experience in my life. I pledged Alpha Phi Alpha fraternity, which of course is a fraternity that Dr. King belonged to. The King, Dr. King lived about two blocks away from Morris Brown College, and at that time, the King Center was not yet where it, became. And so Coretta Scott King used to serve some Sunday's dinner to the college kids, and I had the opportunity to experience that. My wife grew up with the King kids to an extent that her grandmother, my wife's grandmother's property line, backyards, butted with the King's kids' backyards. So they played together, But Atlanta is such a phenomenal community that you do see the Andrew Youngs and others that lived in that community, Daddy King and Sweet Auburn Avenue, and you really don't know that you're in a special place, but you do know that you're in a special place. So I needed to go there because I wanted to serve in the African-American community. And Portland, having 20 or 30,000 blacks, and, out of 700,000, you grow up listening to the other radio stations. and so it was a decided move to go back to Atlanta. Obviously, my father was from Georgia. So I then went to his home, and his mother was still alive. So I spent time there in Savannah in the home, and my father, the home in which he lived was still on a dirt road. They hadn't even paved the street where he was, where he grew up, and same thing for when my mother grew up and going to Paris, Texas. It was not paved. So to go back and to have those true blue experiences really lent well into my spirit, And then there was just so much about Atlanta and the church community, the educational community, and the community at large that seeded into my spirit. So,
can I interrupt you here for a second?
Yes, ma'am.
When you mentioned your mother's from Paris, Texas, and that's a real historic place, Paris, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And then I wanted to ask you, I want you to talk a little bit about that. And then I wanted to ask you about, you said you were able to spend some time with your father's grandmother. Is that what you said?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which means that they were real close to the enslavement period. And so I was wondering, did you get any of those stories when you were talking to your elder relatives?
Yeah, you know, interestingly, my grandmother, she was not a slave. Her parents were,
mm-hmm.
I think, out of slavery.
Mm-hmm.
But she did talk about what it was to have to live with white people, work with white people. And, you know, she would tell stories about interacting with them on non-work days. And basically she would say how they would never, ever dare go around them without really dressing up so as to let them know that these were not servants of yours. These were people who worked with you. And she would tell those stories using a great picturesque language, if you understand me. And I know a little bit about Paris, Texas, and some of the racial issues there over the years, but I do know that it is just, you know, like when I was driving there about maybe 15 years ago, I ran across the sign on one of the cities that said we have the richest dirt and the nicest N-word in the whole world here. And, I mean, it's the sign. You know, when I told my sister about it, because she came, we were going to a family reunion, she said, yeah, that sign has been there. You know, when she was a girl, that sign was there. And so I guess it's there now in memorial. I don't know why it was still up. But on the Paris, Texas, you know, was where at the time Kimberly Clark was there, and I think Campbell Soup were the two big industries, but a very impoverished community nonetheless. It extremely poor community.
Yeah. How is it now?
Extremely poor community.
Yeah. You know, when you talk about, you know, going to visit your parents' homes and them not, the place is not having changed much in all the years, you know, since they have been gone, they sounded like a lot of the places that I visited in Africa. There, you step out, you step in. There's no paved street. I mean, when you're walking, I mean, like if it's paved, it's real intermittent. The paved parts.
Well,
and
one of the stories that I could share briefly is that I went to the one of the churches that are. Our family, my mother's family went to, it was Evergreen Baptist Church, was one of them. The big hospitality Church of God in Christ was another one. But in this particular case, it was Evergreen Baptist Church. And so the pastor happened to be there that afternoon, and he was an older man, so he did know my people of that generation. And so I asked him what he was doing in the church, and they said that they were going to, you know, they were having a fundraiser on tomorrow because they're buying 5 acres of land. And I said, oh, wow, what you going to do with the land? He said, I'm going to build on the land. I said, what are you buying the land for? I mean, how much is it going to cost? And by that time, I had already given him a $200 offering. He said, well, the 5 acres are $50 each in back taxes. I said, $50 each in back taxes? And he said, yeah, I mean, and I said, well, can I get my $200 check back? And then I took the check back, tore it up, and gave him $500. I said, that ought to get the land for you. So that the money you take up on Sunday can go for something else. But the idea that 15 years ago in America that there is an acre of land going for $50 on back taxes, that's how impoverished they are. That's the point I'm making.
That's amazing.
It's very amazing,
So your undergraduate degree is in psychology?
In psychology, my master's in pastoral care, and my PhD work. By the time I got into my PhD work, I began with pastoral care, but I began to shift because I had gotten much more involved in pastoring, and the shift took me into theology. And so, but I went to Claremont because, now, you know, I did apply at Boston University because that's where Dr. King went, right?
Right, yes.
And so it was, you know, what else to do? But Boston had a more of an academic goal for its doctoral students. And I knew I wanted to pastor, and I always wanted to pastor. And so Claremont had both the pastoral mindset as well as the academic scholarly mindset. And so that's really how I chose Claremont place. Sure.
Because I just finished reading a book. I'll look, see if I can find it and tell you the title. But it was by one of the organizers in the civil rights movement, and he was talking about Boston University and the argument that you know King had with his dad because he didn't want him to go to Boston because of that same reason. You know, he wanted him to just pastor, but Martin King, you know, he wanted to continue with his education and become really, you know, really prepared academically for what he had to do. And, you know, I don't know if spiritually in his spirit he had like some kind of inclination, but it certainly served him well, you know, all of that preparation to do the work that he did in such a short period of time before he was gone from us, you know.
Interestingly enough, it's interesting how we, you know, and it's good that you lifted up the interpersonal struggles that we have one with another. I am one that just don't believe, I do not believe that Martin Luther King said one day I'll, you know, do a march on Washington, I'll get the Voting Rights Act done, Housing Rights Act, then, you know, I'll go to Memphis and get shot and, you know, have streets named after me. I don't think that was his mind at all. I think it was the mind of God, but not Dr. King's mind. I think that, interesting, he did struggle with an academic lifestyle, as a career pathway, as well as the pastoral pathway. And as he was finishing his degree, you know, because he had not finished it when he took over at the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, he decided to go back south, where his, you know, wife was from Alabama, and probably just some of those natural, maybe political standpoints of how you make moves in your life. Let me satisfy this person. Let me get this person off my back. I can do this for a while I, you know, make a little money, pay these bills up, you know, get a little family going together, and then I'll move on down the road. And then, you know, another life reality comes into play, because we know that they did not choose, you know, the people at the meeting that night did not choose Dr. King for his, you know, intellectual mind, nor for the fact that he was northern educated and southern born and raised, they thought he was young, inexperienced, and expendable. So that if it doesn't go right, he can start all over again somewhere else. He had a big-time daddy in Atlanta that could get him going again. And that the others were not willing, you know, said that we have a lot to lose if this doesn't go right. And basically they, you know, said, okay, you know, and Dr. King, whether he was cognizant of that reality at the time, he certainly learned of it later on. And, you know, that's how he got, you know, announced. Chosen to be president of the organization, not chosen to be who he became, you know, but just how life just unfolds. So, you know, it is interesting when you do read those stories that, you know, we become what God wants us to, but our journey is, you know, pretty everyday basic journey of making choices. Hopefully they're the right choices, and then doing our best when we, because the other thing is, I don't think Dr. King nor the committee had any idea that the first rally would be as big, that they were really stunned and blown away, which showed that the people were already at the point of wanting to do something. And what Rosa Parks did that day spoke to that concern and touch the nerve in the right way, and it just exploded, because there were other bus boycotts prior to that that, you know, did not receive the same kind of reaction. But this one here was, you know, as they say of that German word Zeitgeist, it was the, you know, it came at the right time, and the presence of God was there, and it was on.
This period right now, the time between Mahatma Gandhi dying and Martin King being killed, and maybe, I'm not certain that there's other people in this period as well, but it's called the Season of Peace.
Right.
And it ends, I believe, on April 4th, which is the anniversary of Martin King's being assassinated.
Right.
And then I think about the title of your of your concert, second annual Voice of Healing concert, and I was wondering if you could, we've been going on for a bit, it's been a really interesting conversation. I was wondering if you could talk about sort of the whole idea of you know, this healing that comes through art, and within that process, we also have, you know, we're sort of, I think your job and the kind of people that are in the spirit work, whether it's, you know, Christianity or something else, you know, we're working on sort of helping people sort of stay in touch with the humanity of themselves.
Right.
Because as I was speaking with Mama C, just because we're in this form doesn't mean that we are human.
Right.
We see a lot of atrocities happening, you know, really horrible things, and that means the person is not in their form. You know, they're not in the form, I believe, that the Creator made us, you know, which is human. So, you know, the kind of work you do sort of helps us, call us back to that, and I think artists do that, too. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
The Healing Body and Soul Benefit Concert is the name that is applied there for two particular reasons. The first reason is that there does exist a soul, and the soul does get hurt and broken and needs to be healed. But the body, there is no soul that does not exist without a body. And unless we heal bodies, we are never really healing souls. If the only thing we're concerned about is the soul, and we pretty well don't give a doggone about the body, then that soul will continue to be, you know, to be hurt. This is a bad example, but that's like a fur coat and a paper bag in a snowstorm. You know, the body is the paper bag, the soul is the fur coat. That fur coat's going to get, you know, it's going to be damaged if not destroyed. So we have to heal the body. And the body and soul are unified one. The art of music, the arts, speech, drama, poetry, but especially music, there's something about a tune, a sound, even beyond words, that can get into the depth of a person. Both my sons are working on their PhDs in different fields, but they're coming together on the same field of music. My one son is music history, and my other son is going into clinical psych, but he's using music as a part of the therapeutic process. The Healing Body and Soul Concert serves as a three-prong approach. One is that of just proper nutrition, if I could use that word, to partake of a wonderful experience that continues to nourish us and nurture us, continues to bring love to us. A second aspect of it, using a medical model, maybe it's just more of a vaccination, that we do live in a world that is traumatic, that does have atrocities, that can wake you up at night, give you nightmares, you know, and just make life unbearable, and you're not even a part of it per se in terms of a direct partner in the event, but you heard about it through television, through friends or whatever. Maybe it's a loved one or a friend of a good friend of yours that has received some kind of trauma, and it really can work on your spirit. And in turn, that which is happening emotionally, spiritually in us negatively can manifest itself in our bodies. So this concert serves as a vaccinating process, that we have been out there and trying our best to live as God wants us to live, to promote the gospel, but we still get hurt, and that's nothing wrong with that. So that vaccination process keeps us as human, as you have so correctly said. God created us to be human, and he continually works to keep us human. So that third process is that of a direct healing, that there are those of us that have been hurt, have been broken, have been, you know, pushed down, and music and the lyric, the sound even, has a way of lifting our spirits. The instruments that God uses, if you kind of can get the variety here, we have the Berklee High School Jazz Band. So, you know, jazz covers a whole lot of emotional feelings, you know, that can promote that sound, that can touch and connect with somebody else and help their burdens to be lifted and bring that healing and joy into their life. The Oakland Bay Area Community Choir, with its very unique music genre that it perfects in doing, speaks to the blues of people's lives and how the gospel has addressed it and healed it and lifted up, but it does not deny the reality of the atrocities that have happened. The Oakland Youth Chorus, just to see young people do music, is so inspirational, because in a way it's telling us that God still has hope in us, because there's a generation still coming behind us, tells us we got a future, that the end of my days is not the end of all days, and that God is still saying no matter what is going on in the world, there is tomorrow. And then the University Gospel Choir at Berklee, it is astounding, because the majority of the members of the choir, unless it's changed this year, they are not African-American. The majority, and it's almost a 90-voice choir. Oh. They are made up of every race, and maybe they have about 3 or 4 African-Americans in the choir. So, and they, if you close your eyes You couldn't tell the difference. They are Dr. Mark Wilson, D. Mark Wilson, as their director. He's a phenomenal director, and he makes that sound come through, and you feel at that point the pathos of gospel music, you know, how gospel music does have a certain catharsis process. It does have a certain rumbling of the trouble of the heart, and it has a certain enrapturing of the joy of God that breaks into our history and heals us of our wounds, but does more than that, gives us new life. It's just not a healing and then we return back to the hell that we were in. He liberates us from that hell and moves us into another life and enables us to help change our hell into the heavens that it needs to be in these days and times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, transformative.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, you know, with your mentor, Martin King, I think that's what he was all about.
Yes.
And he spoke about that, too, how
yes.
you don't have to wait for the sweet by and by.
No.
You know,
the beloved community is about justice, is about peace, which, of course, is not the absence of tension, but the presence of wholeness, the presence of equality. It's a marvelous thing that, you know, when I heard the president talk about the preschool program, and then you hear, well, you know, we don't have the money to pay for it. You know, we don't have the money. And then it's kind of like, well, now, you can pay for it when they're four, or we can pay for it when they're 24 by the lack of equipping that has taken place for jobs, for the world market, for the betterment of humankind, let alone the criminal element issue. And but we are so rich. I mean, we are so rich. Do we expect the benefits of the beloved community from a poverty, from a, you know, I don't have to pay for it standpoint? And the answer to that is no. You know, we must pay for it. It's the only way that we really have an investment in it, because, you know, free stuff has a way of not really meaning that much to us. But the idea that we can live in a place where we are not murdering each other, where we can remove guns from our community, where everybody can have medical treatment, it is not a privilege, it is a right. The right to education, the right to a good place to live, the right to walk down the street unmolested, the right not to be looked upon because of my sex or because of my sexual orientation or because of my color, and be seen as an alien, you know, or to be seen as an alien because I'm not an American, which by in and of itself, the only Americans would be Indians, so all of us would be aliens. It's very interesting how we disenfranchise everybody but ourselves. But I think the beloved community is the only way to bring together the uniquenesses of all of us in a harmonious way instead of in a broken way, which always keeps us at odds. And we have the ability. We have the ability. We have the money. We just have to want to. Mm-hmm. That's all it is. We just have to want to.
Yeah. Well, let everyone know we're speaking to Reverend Dr. Leslie R. White. He's the senior pastor at St. Paul African Methodist Episcopal Church, located at 2420 Ashby Avenue in Berkeley. And we're speaking about the second annual Voice of Healing Body and Soul concert, which is that a Sunday?
Yes, Sunday.
Yes, Sunday. Oh, it's the fourth Sunday. Okay, Sunday, the last Sunday in February, this very short month where we're supposed to, you know, recognize and honor the contributions of people of African descent to this great nation. So what the concert is February 24th at 4 o'clock, and it's featuring these wonderful choirs and choruses, the East Bay Joint Mass Choir with Terry Simmons as director, and she's the person that told me about you. the Oakland Youth Chorus with Linnell Martin as artistic director, the UC Berkeley Gospel Choir with Dr. D. Mark Wilson as the director, the Berkeley High School Jazz Band with Sarah Klein as director, and the Oakland Bay Area Community Choir with Professor William Bell as director, and I teach at the College of Alameda, and I'm really happy that, you know, he graced those hallowed walls with his tenure there as the jazz professor for all the many years he did, and he is just such a phenomenal musician and director that, you know, sort of historic in our area.
Yes, he is. Yeah, we will be, another friend of mine, Reverend Byron Williams, of Resurrection Community Church here in Berkeley, and D. Mark, right, and D. Mark Wilson, we are putting together a kind of a musical, it's more of a it's musical dance, spoken word event with Dr. Wilson, using music that is not of the church, but is what we consider to have messages, you know, like Stevie Wonder's When Is There a Time to Love, Curtis Mayfield, We're a Winner, Nas, I Know I Can, using different, and kind of bringing them, weaving a story together, a narrative together that speaks the message in those songs. And we're going to be putting that together, so I'd like to come back and talk with you about
it. Oh, certainly, certainly. Yeah, that'd be really great.
By the middle of the summertime is what we're looking toward. But it's a, you know, some songs at the Kennedy Center, I don't know if you saw that particular event here recently where they honored Led Zeppelin, right?
And I missed that. Oh, that's great.
Yeah, Stairway to Heaven was their song that they sung. And Stairway to Heaven basically is about, you know, it's a love song. But the way that they did it that night, they had an African-American choir. They had other singers and dancers. It, you know, it does bring tears to your eyes like it never did before. And it does bring in another angle to the message about Stairway to Heaven, you know. So it's it's out of that context. Pastor Williams had this idea of us getting together and choosing different songs like Sly and the Family Stone, I Want to Take You Higher, putting our spin on it, but then bringing it into the church life and bringing it into the community that these messages are out there for us. And it really shows that God has been giving his messages with the help of the church and in spite of the help of the church, but not really any of that, but it goes to say how God continually works within the community to bring about the beloved community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, you know, it's sort of like if it's good, then it's God, right?
I don't know about that. but I definitely believe that God reaches much further than maybe the church has ability, and which is the promise of God that he would continue to redeem his people. So whether or not I know it, you know, and I know Stevie Wonder, you know, is involved in the Christian church, but whether or not he knows he's writing a song that has a message of God in it. I don't know. But when you hear "When Is There a Time to Love," mm-hmm. or when you hear Michael Jackson's "Earth Song," it kind of makes you just, you know, shudder, have some chills, because you hear a deeper message about, let's make this world better. You know, we got time for everything, Stevie Wonder would say. So when is there a time for love then, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And raising that question, you know, the messages of those songs, I think they are played in places where the cross does not hang. They are sung in places where the Bible is not in existence, but the message of God gets to that person and you know, hopefully it nourishes them, vaccinates them, and heals them.
Oh yeah, certainly it does. You know, there are a lot of different paths, and some
yes.
of them don't even have names. And you know, when one thinks about those people that are called into service, you know, sometimes you don't know you got drafted. So,
right.
And so what happens is people that have been studying, people that are more aware, they see, oh, yeah, you're my people, you're my people. You only know you're my people, but you're my people.
Well, what's also interesting, and I meant to bring this up about the gospel jazz, but
uh-huh.
in the hip-hop community,
mm-hmm.
You know, there is this overall, there is a spiritual angle, mm-hmm. and the church, whatever you call it, black church, white church, the Christian church, Christendom, has basically ignored it, even if they're aware of it. But there are tens of thousands of young people who gather without the sanction of the church, but they are working out their spiritual life. They
mm-hmm.
talk about God. They talk about their walk with God, and they worship God at a level and in numbers that would astound you. But it's not underground, as one would say. But it's kind of like when Mike Wallace learned about the Nation of Islam, you know, and he was more astounded that this many numbers of people could have been gathering, and you know, we didn't know anything about it. Well, the same thing with Christian hip hop. You know, God is still breaking out in ways in which we in our own little corners and concerned about our own little petty minor issues, it don't come to know where God is moving in these new places. So as you have rightly said, these new pathways, you know, are there, and we may not know their name, but it's still working it out, you know,
mm-hmm.
toward
God. So these people that are called into
yeah.
service, and they're answering the call, because you know, spirit answers calls.
That's right.
And you know, it's, you know, you people don't usually, artists don't usually interpret it. They just like just do what they're called to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, you know, you did what you were called to do. And
yeah.
I was just looking at just, you know, you've only been at St. Paul AME Church, you know, for what? This is your fourth anniversary year?
Just finished my third year, right, into the fourth year, right.
Right, yeah. And then before that, you were in Watts.
That's right.
And then before there, you were in St. Louis.
St. Louis.
And then you were in Kansas. And
Wichita.
Yeah, and you were, that's where my earlier guest, she's from Kansas City.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Her husband founded the Black Panther Party there, and then they had to leave the country, and so that's why they're in Tanzania. They've been there for over 40 years now.
40?
Over 40 years. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah. There was a film called A Panther in Africa that outlines Brother Pete O'Neill's life and his wife, Mama Charlotte O'Neill, and their two children, and what good work they've been doing there using art as a tool for community healing and
mm-hmm.
unification, you know, the African and the African-American, and just they just done some wonderful things there, you know, in their work. And Brother Pete can't come back to this country, but Mama Charlotte comes and she does this healing, the community tour, and so she always comes to the Bay Area when she comes through. And so she was here and spoke at Laney College and showed a film, a new film that's going to be debuting at the Pan-African Film Festival in Southern California in Los Angeles, which you're aware of because you had a church there. Yeah, so anyway, it's like been really, really wonderful talking to you, and definitely we'll have to have you back on to talk more about the work that you are doing and the work that you're manifesting at St. Paul AME Church and this healing, Voice of Healing, Body and Soul concert just sounds simply fantastic. And I want to drop out something just because it's going to be opening next month. And and I was wondering for the third Sunday in March, because March does have a third Sunday, are you doing anything around Women's History Month? Are you going to have like all women something or another concert? But I wanted to, before you answer that question, I want to mention this film because, you know, this is a fundraiser for these ministries that that you have to help, you know, with hunger and disaster relief and things like that. In the Pan-African diaspora, there's a movie called A Place at the Table, and it's from the people that brought us Food, Inc. And it looks at hunger in America. There are so many hungry children and adults in our country, and I'm sure you know that because you have a church, and most churches are picking up, you know, the sort of that dearth where people who don't have enough, that's where they go, because a lot of churches feed people. You know, you have the food pantries and things like that, and it's really unfortunate because we have enough food, but people are hungry in our country.
Well, I think that our challenge, in many respects, revolves around our own personal security and our own personal greed. You know, how much food does my cabinet need to have so I don't feel hungry? How many alarms does my house need to have so I can feel secure? I was listening to the radio last night and the commercial came on, who's watching your house when you're not there to watch it, you know? And it's like, okay, this, you know, revolving around security, you know? So if you listen to our commercials, it's about our security, it's about our food. And you're right, there's a lot of hunger, but it's not because of a lack of food. It's because of the issues of greed and security.
Yeah, but it's mostly, you know, our government is subsidizing the corporate, food industry, you know, because now the small family farms are gone and the people that are getting the subsidies are these corporations, and they make the money with these foods, like the grains that are not nutritious. So it's more expensive to get an apple than it is to buy, to buy products made from wheat and corn and soy. So, yeah, you will really, really like this film once it comes out, once it opens. And you might want to actually, take a group of folks there and then have, like, a conversation about food security and sort of some lobbying we could do to the government to feed the children in particular, you know, like make the school lunches nutritious as opposed to full of sugar and starch. Because another big problem in our country is obesity and childhood diabetes type 2, which is preventable.
I know it's very difficult for us to personalize, and I don't mean make personal, but I've long since stopped using the term the government as if the government is different from Barack Obama or Dianne Feinstein or Barbara Lee. That's who we're talking about. We're not talking about the government and not them. Or we're not talking about industry and not talking about the president of Kellogg or the president of Beatrice Foods or things of that nature. We're not talking about entertainment and not talking about Brother Johnson or we're not talking about the Dodgers and not talking about Magic Johnson, you know. the entities cannot become people. They are not people, but they are run by people. And so it still revolves around security and greed for me. When the gas prices go up and everybody is struggling and the oil president says, we just having a hard time, and then Wall Street says they've made the biggest profits ever. I know what hard time means to me, and it has never meant the biggest profits ever. But we depersonalize so much that we aren't willing to challenge that person, that if the person at the pump is suffering, but you in the cashier's box is not suffering, then we are not suffering. I am suffering. You are getting the biggest profits ever. And that needs to stop. When we are all suffering, that's when nobody makes the biggest profits in history. And so I think because of our, you know, we have a great tendency to want to complicate everything, you know, complicate everything. But in reality, it's pretty simple. It's just us people, and we the people have got to do better, and not make the government so impersonal as to make it a person, or make the oil industry so impersonal as to make it a person. And to come back and somebody question, how come, you know, the question is not what happened at the fuel pump, not what happened at the refinery, but the question is, how come that man up there says he need that much money?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're not saying, you know, he shouldn't make enough money to make things happen. We're just saying, how come he making the biggest profits ever if the things are as hard as they are? Because if you're making $10 an hour and there was a time when you only had to live off of a dollar, and now you're making $10 an hour, but it takes you $9 an hour to live, but the studio or the industry you're working for says, we've got the biggest profits ever.
Mm-hmm.
And you're saying, well, wait a minute, I'm suffering. How can we be having the biggest profits ever? You're still paying me $10. That ain't the truth. I'm not going with that. That's when we go on what, strike?
Right.
You know, whole lot of things go on, but I think as long as we seek to make the government something that we can never get a hand on, or make an industry something we can't make a hand on, lay a hand on, you know, because in the civil rights movement, we were against segregation, but it became the bus company. You know, after a while, you got to make this thing. You know, what are you after? Don't go into the stores on Easter to buy the clothes. So now, Mr. Kress, you can hold to your white only, can't, you know, blacks can't try on clothes in your store, and we can hold on to our money. While we got our money, we can wear our old clothes and still eat some food. When you don't have our money, you can't pay these folks, you're going to go down and going to have some real struggle. Which one do you want?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at that point, it becomes very clear who we are struggling against. And we're not struggling against this store. We're struggling against Mr. Kress himself, or Mr. Woolworth himself. And pretty soon those barriers break down. If in fact they break down, but they relent, and we are able to move forward. So that, you know, so I don't want to disagree with you, but I really
like that. Yeah, I like that, the specificity. I mean, you know, like, these companies that are making all these profits, these growers, they're getting all these tax dollars,
mm-hmm.
to be able to undermine our health and nutrition.
Right.
They
right.
do have names, and we can boycott.
That's right.
You know, these various entities that produce these cereals that we our children ask for because they're full of sugar, and sugar is a narcotic. And, you know, once you start eating sugar and salt, you crave it. So what if we boycott Twinkies and and
Ooh, not Twinkies, no, but something else, yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, and I don't know, with Fruit Loops and...
Yeah, right.
And, you know, Kool-Aid and whatever. And say, no, you know, we're not going to eat this garbage anymore.
Yeah.
Because it's killing us. It's killing our children. Children now, from the film, they were talking about how they're getting diseases that... normally people get when they're older, if they get them at all, a lot younger, and their life expectancy is shorter than ours. They're going to live shorter lives because of this garbage that they're eating called nutritious food. And it's just,
yeah, you know, you're absolutely right. And I guess as much as we don't like to admit it, if I can go back to my own journey, Alfred Lee Henderson, L.S.H. Cassin, seeded into my life what I'm supposed to be about. The Ku Klux Klan marched down the street in Oregon when
I was
alive. Yes.
Oregon?
In Portland, Oregon. Oh, yeah.
Wow.
They marched down the street. They marched through the black community. There was a lot, you know, there was the thing of walking into a store and people walking behind you because, you know, you're just a little thief, a little thug. I remember going to a track meet in a whiter part of Portland and being called the N-word. What are you doing out here running on our field, you know? I remember police stopping us, you know, little kids on the street, telling us we're a bunch of N's, you know. But I'm saying, with all of that income data on my spirit, Alfred Lee Henderson, L.S.H. Cassin, seated in my spirit that those two persons, if it's one thing for us to do all the big work and, you know, all that kind of stuff, but it does come down to what Rosa Parks did. I will sit on the seat. Mm-hmm. And I, the parent, will teach my child to read. I, the man, will respect my body, and I will respect every other woman's body. It's, you know, we can always make stuff so universal, so global, as to nobody takes any personal responsibility. But the real side is, you know, and it's, you know, I'm sure your parents probably said something like this to you. If everybody else is, if all the other kids were running and jumping off a cliff, would you be dumb enough to do it too? And then, you know, your parents are trying to tell you, just because everybody else is doing it doesn't mean you're supposed to get in line, you know, when you know it's something stupid.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think with us, we have to empower people that you individually can make a difference. God called Moses, not the whole Israelite people, but God said to Moses, I'm sending you, and, you know, to be this liberator. The power of one positive person is overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, we can forever talk about what, and I think we should, you know, bad nutrition, blase, blase, blase. But the American marketplace understands the use of money. And I woke up this morning, turned on my TV set after a few moments, and there was a commercial that I thought was a joke. I turned to it, turned to another station, and I kept turning, but I heard the commercial. And it says Lay's potato chips, a chicken and waffles. And I thought it was a joke. And I said, let me turn back to this and see what this, you know, cause I'm thinking about Roscoe's Chicken and Waffles or something like that. And it's for real. You know, now, potato chips already alone. Now you're going to add waffle and fried chicken, you know, flavoring to it. Hmm. Come on. Somebody got to, you know, I couldn't eat potato chips. I had to sneak to eat potato chips.
Yeah, empty calories. Yeah, and then, you know, a lot of children.
My mother did not cooperate with me. Mm-hmm. She raised me. She didn't cooperate with me. She didn't negotiate with me.
Yeah.
She raised me. My parents raised me. Mm-hmm. And so that's the only thing I'm saying. You know, I mean, we can go on and on about, you know, industry and all that, but and I think that that's a good discussion.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, if we finish our discussion and then we say, yeah, let's go get this hamburger, well, now, you know, that done killed the discussion. Let's go eat properly. Now that's a different matter, you know.
Yeah.
That's, you know, personal responsibility.
Yeah. And we are responsible for our children.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and it's also, you know, holding the corporations accountable, holding those legislators that we have that represent us, you know, like you mentioned, Barbara Lee and
mm-hmm.
Dianne Feinstein and Nancy Pelosi and
mm-hmm.
others, you know, on the federal level as well as the state level. And we have a governor, you know, Brown, and all those folks and the monies, they go into, you know, these school lunches and breakfasts that, you know, since the Black Panther Party stopped, you know, providing them, have gone really downhill. I mean, when I had school lunch as a kid, it was nutritious, and it was cooked
mm-hmm.
right there on the premises. I grew up in San Francisco, John McLaurin Elementary School. Great lunches. Now, you know, mostly starch and sugar. So it's also a re-education because, you know, children, we're raising them. And so if they're being raised on food that's unhealthy, how are they supposed to know about what the healthy choices are?
Right.
So the film also looks at, you know, re-education. But I do want to play a little bit of this Bonnie Boswell interview about her film, Whitney Young.
Well, then we need to conclude our time. I look forward to seeing you on the 24th of February. If your schedule and busy time allows, I would really love to have you here and to thank you personally and to the congregation for your great work that you do in this community.
Oh, thank you so much. And, I'm looking forward to, to our continued association.
Yes.
You know, your ministry is a ministry that, you know, I definitely can get with.
Bless God. Bless God. Come visit.
I certainly
Services will. Every Sunday at 9:30 a.m.
Okay, cool. And do you all have a website for your...
Yes, we do.
Okay, what is it?
The website is St. Paul Berkeley. com.
Okay, so is it ST or spell out Saint?
STPAULBERKELEY.com.
Okay.
Of course, www.stpaul.
Okay, is there a phone number?
510-848-2050.
Okay, great. Well, super. Well, thank you so much, and I hope you have
thank
a great rest
too,
of the day
Wanda.
And a wonderful weekend.
God be with you. Bye-bye.
God be with you, too. Peace and blessings.
Bye-bye.
Bye. So we're going to just shift right into this rebroadcast of the Bonnie Boswell interview about the film that she produced about her uncle, Whitney Young, power broker. We were going to play a couple of pieces from Mama Charlotte, but we'll play that on Wednesday's show because I want to jump right into this interview because it's long and it's going to go into the archives afterwards. So if you haven't heard it, just stay with us on the air and listen to it because it's really phenomenal how she came to unpack the legacy that is her uncle, Whitney Young, who left us all too soon and who really did much to bring about concrete participation of people of African descent in this democracy via jobs and education and housing. Yeah, he was the one looking at a Marshall Plan for African Americans here in this country, just to sort of right the civil wrongs that were a part of our community after the period known as Reconstruction ended, and for all intents and purposes, slavery, just called something else, Jim Crow or whatever, became the rule, if not the rule of law, definitely became the rule of practice here in the United States until the Civil Rights Movement popularized and by Martin King. But definitely the resistance started around the 1950s. And one can see that in the work of Mama Charlotte and Brother Pete as well, as folks like Brother, thinking about the Radio Free Africa, Robert F. Williams, his work. So anyway, here we are, Bonnie Boswell, speaking about Whitney Young and the film Power Broker, which is airing on February 18th, which is Monday, throughout the nation on ITVS. Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black Arts and Cultural Program of the African Sisters Media Network. We are joined in the studio by Bonnie Boswell. She's executive producer of this wonderful new film, The Power Broker, Whitney Young's Fight for Civil Rights. And this film is going to be having a national debut on ITVS on February 18th. Good morning.
Good morning.
The film about your uncle is just simply fantastic. Let me tell the audience a little bit about you, and then you could tell us about your Uncle Whitney
okay.
and this great film that you produced.
Ms.
Boswell is an award-winning reporter, producer, commentator, and talk show host. She is Chief Executive Officer of Blue Gate Media, Program Director of the Whitney Young Film and Leadership Program, and the executive producer of this film that we're going to be talking about this morning, The Power Broker, Whitney Young's Fight for Civil Rights. Ms. Boswell's articles have appeared in the Los Angeles Times, Essence Magazine, and the Radcliffe Quarterly. She has been a guest on NBC's Today Show, CNN's Talk Back, the CBS Radio Network, and at Harvard University, Princeton University, and the University of Southern California. She is also a past executive board member of the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences, and she was just here on Martin King Day for a special Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area screening of the film. How did that go?
It was great. It was really wonderful. I had never been to MOAG before, and it was fun being in that space, especially on the day of inauguration and Martin Luther King's birthday. So that was fun, and we had some veterans of the civil rights movement who were on the panel and were able to share some of their experiences. And I always love, after the screening, to talk with the audience and really get their impressions. So that's always one of the big payoffs for me.
So tell us about the making of this film and your uncle. You said that you knew him as a member of the family, as Uncle Whitney, but you didn't know sort of the breadth of the work that he did, for sort of ensuring the civil rights, particularly economic development, for the Black community here in America.
Well, yeah, I was, a young girl when the March on Washington was going on. That was the first time I saw him as more than just an uncle. Before then, he was this really nice, wonderful guy at our family gatherings, and I really had a warmness in my heart for him always, but I didn't really understand his national prominence and role until I saw him on television when I was with my grandparents in Kentucky, which is where I spent a lot of time myself as a kid with his parents. And the excitement around the house, seeing him on television, I was like, wow, what's Uncle Whitney doing on television? So that was my first impression. So I didn't really grasp, the significance of, his work at all at that time. And, of course, I was busy being, a kid and doing my school, so I didn't really understand, all the things he was involved in. But, as I began to enter into an integrated world myself, because I had been in basically a segregated environment for a lot of years myself, but then as I started going to an integrated school, University of Chicago Laboratory School and High Park in Chicago, then, you know, I was going through a lot of my own adjustments, and so I began to really personally, you know, go through an encounter with racism in a different kind of way. So I think, you know, what he was doing began to take on new meaning for me personally.
Yeah. He was born July 31st, 1921, so he was a contemporary of Malcolm X and Martin King, and of course, and then he passed, you know, March 11, 1971, so he didn't live that long.
Right, he was 49 years old, very young man.
Yeah, really young. Mm-hmm. Right, but he did so much. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it was really, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to make this film, was because I wanted to lift up his accomplishments, certainly, which were many, but also the role he played, too. You know, it's kind of the ideas that he represents even today, I think are really important for us to think about. I got the idea for doing this film when I was asked to speak on behalf of my mother, who passed away in 2002, and so I began to reflect on Uncle Whitney's capacity to build bridges between ethnic groups and economic groups. And I thought, well, this is the kind of leadership we really need to hold up as a role model in America and in the world, really, because, you know, we are a diverse society. And so whoever has the capacity to, you know, create consensus is somebody we really need to learn from. So that was my intention in doing the film.
Right, yeah. I was just looking at sort of, you know, sort of the legacy that he was born into. You know, his mother, Laura Young, was the first female postmistress in Kentucky, the first African-American postmistress in Kentucky, and then the second in the United States. And then his father was president of Lincoln Institute, which was where your uncle was raised and educated. And then he... you know, he was so well educated. You know, he got his bachelor's of science degree from Kentucky State University, a historically black institution, and there he was a member of the Alpha Phi Alpha fraternity. And then during World War II, he trained as an electrical engineer at MIT. And then his relationship with his wife was really, really wonderful. You know, he met her at the University of Minnesota, where he earned his master's degree in social work. And I just think, wow, that's so interesting, you know, the kind of work he did was so in line with his work, his training, you know.
I agree. He and Margaret actually met at Kentucky State, but he did go to the University of Minnesota and got his social work degree. And, you know, I think as I learned by doing the film, the skill sets that he learned as a professional really helped him make the kind of contribution that he made. So, for example, I mean, I had an opportunity to speak with Dorothy Height about him and, you know, was talking with her about Whitney Young's role as a mediator even within the inner circle of the civil rights leaders. So, you know, people, a lot of times there's the tension between the leaders. And so within the inner circle, Whitney played this consensus-building role. And so I asked her about that, what her opinion was. And I had the assumption that because he had this really beautiful, you know, charismatic personality, that was why he was able to do what he did. But she looked at me with great intensity and, you know, direction and said, talking about herself and him, she said, "We were social workers." And, you know, a light went off in my head when I heard that because, you know, I realized that this is a skill set that social workers have. You know, their mission in a given situation is to bring people together and keep them together. And so that to me was really enlightening on many levels because I realized that this is not, you know, something that is just about personality. But these are skill sets that can be taught to others. So I think that's a really hopeful kind of message that, you know, we can teach young people to become consensus builders, to be mediators. And I think that's exactly what we need moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what I really liked about your film is how you have all these folks, talking about, you know, your uncle that are no longer with us, like Dr. Height, Dorothy Height, and Howard Zinn, and Ossie Davis. It's like, oh my goodness. You've got Donna Rumsfeld, Julian Bond, Vernon Jordan, John Lewis, Kenneth Chenault. I mean, it's like, wow. Talk about how you sort of pulled all these voices together, and talk about, you know, sort of the team. You know, this is like a family affair, right? I mean, your son is worked on the film.
Yeah, exactly. Well, first question, I mean, you know, in terms of, you know, the breadth of interviews we have, I think that kind of shows the good and the bad news about independent filmmaking is that it takes a long time to do, much longer than one would think. And so because the scope of time was so long in terms of, you know, raising the funds to be able to do it and all that, which was the difficult part of it. The good part of it was that we were able to capture people early on who are no longer with us. And even though I had no money to start off with, I had basically like a family camera. And, you know, new friends who had cameras, and I would go into a sitting and say, you know, I remember seeing Dorothy Hyde at one point, and she was like about 90, and I saw her at an Urban League convention giving, interesting, a Whitney Young Award. And, you know, I could tell, you know, she was up in years, and I thought, oh, my gosh, I got to get her, like, next week, you know. And so, you know, I did. I mean, I just would grab these various interviews, all kinds of quality film, I mean, just the whole bit. But at the end of the day, it becomes very, very rich, and I'm so incredibly grateful to have these interviews. And, yes, it has been a family affair. I mean, every, you know, my son was the one of the directors and producers of this film. It was really amazing having him work on this project with me. Neither one of us intended to work on it together. That was not my intention or his intention. He wanted to do feature films, and I thought, you know, working with your son is a whole other zone. So I thought, you know, we'll just kind of do our own thing. But, you know, we were both at a point where it made sense for us to work together, and he brought incredible amounts of vision and energy and perspective, a youthful perspective, and all that to it, and you know, his artistic capabilities are so great, and you know, he was able to help us to, you know, hire another director who's wonderful, Christine Kalafian, and she's amazing. So, and then my husband is a lawyer, and so we were able to get a lot of in-kind help from him, as well as research help. And then I have a younger son who was at Columbia at the time when we were making the film, and the Whitney Young papers are housed at Columbia, so I was like, Evan, can you run up there and get this, you know, piece of document? So, you know, definitely all hands on deck kind of thing. I don't know how you can do without a family.
Wow, it's so amazing. And, you know, he was, in the 1960s, he was the executive director of the National Urban League, and one of the few African Americans who had the ears of those who controlled the levers of power. I'm reading from the synopsis. Fortune 500 CEOs, governors, senators, and presidents. And could you talk about how we use these relationships to gain better access to employment, education, housing, and health care for African Americans, and about his idea for the Marshall Plan for our community? Yet the work he was doing, because he was a lot of times the only black man in these circles, was not seen in a positive light often. I mean, he was so misunderstood. It reminds me of the relationship between W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington, right. You know, and also Marcus Garvey, how the press and the dominant discourse was that, you know, they couldn't all be working for the good of our community, yet they all were.
Right. Right. Now, you know, I think one of the great things is that, you know, Uncle Whitney understood, and I think, you know, eventually, you know, a lot of people who were around at that time understood that everybody was playing a different and important role. Where he at one point had conversations with Malcolm X, when they both acknowledged that each of them were important roles. And, you know, I think that the maturity is to understand that you don't have to have, nor should you have, just one voice at the table. You know, you need people who are going to be, you know, being more vocal, and yet you also need people who are going to, you know, say, okay, how are we going to get this done? I think that one of the things that, you know, is really important is understand that this sensibility that Whitney had as a social worker was able to be translated into his work as a civil rights leader, because, you know, it wasn't enough just to have the voting laws changed and the laws changed to say that, you know, you could live in any place you wanted to live. Of course, that was incredibly important. At the same time, he understood that if you didn't have a good education, you couldn't get a good job, you wouldn't get good money, and therefore you couldn't afford to live in the neighborhood you wanted to live in. So, you know, he was about the business of trying to get the infrastructure in place so that people could live and, you know, carry out a full life wherever they wanted to. And that's, you know, the basics of, you know, economics. So, you know, this is what he was pushing for as a social worker. He really wanted people, and also the mission of the National Urban League was to help people to get those jobs and so on and so forth. So that was his training, his understanding, and his mission. And so he worked, you know, behind the scenes and had conversations with people who had that kind of power, you know, who could influence a company. A Fortune 500 CEO could influence his own company to say, you know, well, we need to have this company become more diverse. And Uncle Whitney always talked about the fact that, you know, this is good for business, first of all. It's a pragmatic approach. You know, it's not just a good thing to do morally, although that is important, but you need to have, you know, an educated workforce. You need to have people who are diverse in your own office. So I think he was able to appeal to people on not only the moral grounds, but on the pragmatic grounds as well.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Talk about some of the, I guess, some of the key landmark kind of things that happened with, you know, sort of that, because of the type of work that that Whitney Young was doing. Could you talk about some of the key, like, for instance, he was you mentioned, well, it's mentioned that, you know, there were some key events in the civil rights era, you know, besides the March on Washington in 1963 and the 1964 Civil Rights Act, that he was directly sort of involved in their implementation. I wonder if you could talk about some of these key landmark legislative successes or economic successes that he was responsible for. I think it's really funny. I think it's Henry Louis Gates Jr. that talked about how he really liked your uncle's voice. He just thought he was so impeccable in his presentation as a person, you know?
Right, exactly. One of my favorite stories, it's not in the film, but it's a great story, I think, that illustrates his capacity to, you know, open up doors and talk about, you know, significant things. I mean, one of the things, just to back up a little bit, obviously, was his domestic Marshall Plan, which is this concept he had about how to really infuse funds and attention into the inner city in order to bring about the kind of systemic change that he thought was going to be important in terms of, you know, leveraging this idea of power to get more money into the community so that you can have better schools and housing and so on and so forth. So, he understood that America had never done this as far as African Americans were concerned at large, and there had never really been a redress of the slavery and the segregation. And so since there had been no prior program to really address this, what he did understand was that America knew about the Marshall Plan, which had been an effort that the United States had made to help to rebuild Western Europe after the war. So there was that, you know, image that everybody had been comfortable with. And what he said was, okay, we bought into this concept of helping to rebuild Western Europe. We should also have the same idea of receptivity to rebuilding the, you know, urban cities. You know, it's the same, and we showed pictures, you know, in the film showing, you know, Germany, war-torn Germany and, you know, and Harlem, you know, so that you could see that there was, they looked almost the same, you know, war-torn kind of places. So I think that was very smart on his part to be able to call it a domestic Marshall Plan, because the concept of the Marshall Plan had already, you know, gained traction, but the idea of it being domestic was the focus. So because of that, he was able to influence Lyndon Johnson later, who was coming into his own in terms of thinking about these issues for the domestic Marshall Plan, I mean, with the war on poverty, race society, And so a lot of programs that we now take for granted really came out of the thinking that Uncle Whitney was able to influence in terms of that. So, you know, Medicaid, which we talk a lot about right now in the country, but people like was a part of that. Head Start was a part of that, you know, early education, Job Corps, you know, all these kinds of programs that have become a part of American fabric. And as Manny Marable says in the film, you know, where would we be without those programs? So I think that kind of influence is really important. The point I was going to make earlier in terms of influencing corporations to become integrated, to really diversify, one of the things my son, Taylor, was asking us to do is to show what life looked like in the 1950s in corporate America, because he, having been born much later, didn't have a sense of what that looked like. But, you know, we kind of got the Mad Men idea, you know, and put it on film so we could, you know, really help people see it was all white, all male, pretty much all the time, you know, mm-hmm. in these big corporations. And so, you know, we showed what that looked like. And so Whitney Young was introducing this concept, which was not was unimaginable to a lot of these corporations to have African Americans there. So he went on a trip to Europe, Eastern Europe, with members of Fortune 500 companies. And, you know, this is the first time, again, many of these men who were, you know, the power elite had really been able to have dialogue or relationship or, you know, long-term, you know, days with, to see an African-American man as a peer, you know, before it's always been maybe, you know, an athlete or an entertainer or some other entity, but, you know, to really deal with him as a peer. And he was in every way. And so one of his, and he was very affable and so on and so forth. So it, apparently at the end of the trip, one of these gentlemen says to Whitney Young, he taps him on the back and said, gee, Whitney, if more Negroes were like you, we wouldn't have any problems. And he said, yes, and if more white people were like me, we wouldn't have any problems. So I love that. Isn't that great? You know, because, you know, it was a point well made. Mm-hmm. You know, it was the truth. But it was, he said it was funny, you know, people would laugh and they go, oh, wait a minute. Yeah, that's right, mm-hmm. you know. So as a result of that trip and his relationship with those CEOs, many went back to their companies and began to really say, okay, we need to have more people of color, you know, in this, JCPenney or IBM or, mm-hmm. you know, the whole group of companies, the Ford Motor Company, that responded to him in that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was just wondering, you know, you mentioned the term imagination, and I just think about how, you know, when your uncle was, you know, sort of moving in these different circles, you know, for the greater good, you know, as a veteran, you know, serving in a segregated union in the Army during World War II, to mediating tensions between the white and African American service members, you know, to his work, you know, in the civil rights movement when he returned from the war. just thinking about sort of what, you know, sort of what did his, you know, what kind of examples did he get from his parents to be able to like step out there like that? Because he was the only one. And you know, that was probably, I mean, not necessarily scary, but, you know, he was isolated. I mean, and yet he was able to hold his own and be really consistent in his message and be really, you know, he just, you know, sort of really held himself to a really high standard. A lot of times, you know, when he was moving in these circles and he was the only one at a lot of points. And then sometimes the folks that were his allies didn't get it. So then he was really alone, and then finally they did get it. Just wondering, you know, from people that you talked to, did he talk to them about sort of the stresses of that? And then yourself, I mean, you've accomplished a whole lot, and I wonder, sort of intergenerationally, sort of that legacy, because he was born at a time when the connection between one's our enslaved ancestors and, you know, freedom, it wasn't that, you know, it wasn't hundreds of years. I mean, you could know people that had experienced enslavement.
Exactly. Well, I think that's a very, very astute question. And actually, the answer to that is one of the reasons I wanted to do the film also, because I was amazed at, you know, his capacity to, as you said, hold his own at the time. But I also felt that I understood a little bit about where that came from, because I was raised by my grandparents when I was very young. You know, my first early years were with my grandparents, and I kind of got firsthand some of those messages. And it wasn't just me. My grandparents, you know, were the heads of a high school, so they gave these lessons not only to their own family, but to, you know, the many, many 400 African-American students who came through there every year. So their job, my grandparents' job in many ways, was to prepare everybody to be able to move from segregation to integration. And so they wanted to empower those young people, all of us, to have the skill sets, the mindfulness to understand what we were encountering and to not let our emotions get away from us. And I think Uncle Whitney, particularly, again, growing up directly in segregation, mine was a little bit more benign. I don't know if I could have served and asked in a segregated army company. I think that would have really made me crazy. But at any rate, that was the time, and a lot of, and, you know, many men did that. But one of the things my grandfather said, which I think is a good story, and it was following a basketball game Uncle Whitney had attended for school, and, you know, their team had been victorious. They went to a diner. He and the teammates went to a diner, a local diner, and were refused entrance. They were asked to eat in the back. And Uncle Whitney apparently was furious about this, went home and told his father about this great injustice. And my grandfather said, well, first of all, Whitney, never let anybody drag you so low as to hate them.
Mm. Wow.
And, you know, he also said, don't get mad, get smart, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't about letting your emotions run away with you, but the idea of character was extraordinarily important in our family and in the lessons that both of my grandparents tried to impart to young people. Because that's basically, at that point in time, that was all you had. I mean, you might have had education, but still you were, if you were an African-American, male or female, but particularly male, your life was in jeopardy. You know, if you stepped outside the boundaries of your community, you know, you could be lynched for not much, you know, on your part. So, and nobody had any real money, I mean, to speak of. It was, you know, in life, mom always talked about the A's beans. Seven different times a day, 7 days a week, you know. But they did have education. They were education-oriented. And also, again, this whole aspect of character was very, very important. So it was something with my grandmother carried herself with, you know, great. You would have thought she was, you know, was the Queen of England or something. I mean, it was just kind of her, she was majestic, basically. You know, she just had this quality about her. And not only that, but she made sure that all of us coming through that school, including, you know, her three children, knew how to talk to people, knew how to engage people. So, you know, she would say to me, I remember, she'd say, you know, go up to Mrs. Brown, say hello, Mrs. Brown, look them in the eye, shake their hand. And she used to do that with Uncle Whitney, too. I know my aunt mentioned that. She would do it with everybody, you know, taught people how to behave. So, you know, so they won respect. I think there's an important lesson moving forward, again, that we don't let other people influence our behavior so that we drag ourselves down, so that you know, that our character is diminished, because character is ultimately what you have.
Hmm. Wow, yeah. So were you speaking about your grandmother, Laura?
Yes, I was, yeah, Laura,
okay.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
She is very much the, you know, the mother of the campus. And, you know, I mean, the kids were like, you know, when it was yes, Mrs. Young and no, Mrs. Young. I mean, they learned all of that. And to have pride in themselves. So, but also to be a part of community. And that's the other thing I think is important. I mean, my grandparents really stressed the involvement in the care and protection of everybody on the campus. And so if somebody was sick, you know, then, you know, our family would take them food. Or I remember Aunt Eleanor, my aunt, saying that when kids would come to campus and they didn't have any clothes, my grandmother would go into their closets, her kids' closets, and pull out clothes for them. And, you know, when I was a little girl, I was like 6 years old, and I spent a lot of time running around this beautiful campus. But before I could go out and play, she made sure that I went over to see how the senior citizen was doing. She was a nurse at the school. She lived there. You know, I would take my friends over to spend time with her, and I would go over to the custodians and take my friends over there and went to the, you know, we had these rounds that we had to do every day just to make sure everybody was okay. And that became a part of my DNA, is thinking about, you know, the community, protecting and offering, you know, whatever I could to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's wonderful. So where did you get your training? Where did you go to school?
Well, I started at Tufts University, and then I transferred to Harvard University and finished there, and then I went to MIT for my master's degree. So that was the academics. That was the academic side of stuff. Yeah.
Oh, that's really cool. So, because your uncle went to MIT too, right?
Yeah, he did. Absolutely.
So,
yeah.
Did you like run into any of his legacy at MIT?
Not so much in time. Also, when I was in school, I was kind of, in many ways, more out of school than in school. I mean, when I was at Harvard, I spent 3 days a week working at a daycare center in Roxbury. Mm-hmm. So, you know, my relationship with school was very, you know, it was like in school four hours a week and then out of school in the community the rest of the time. So, and same thing when I was at MIT. I spent, you know, a lot of time being other places, doing other things. So I really wanted to be out, you know, involved. And so being at school at that time was kind of challenging for me. I mean, I continued and I finished, but it was, you know, it was not, I wanted to be more where the action was. And, you know, being able to give and be part of the community is what I was really interested in. That's what I did.
So is your training in journalism?
No, not at all. I have no degree in journalism.
Social work?
At all, not even social work, no. Because, you know, I was also a little rebellious, I have to say. So I was going to be the not social worker in the family, you know. But journalism has been my tool to really, you know, deal with some of the same issues. So my BA is in anthropology, which is a wonderful topic because it means you can do anything, and it falls within that subject. And then my master's is in city planning, which, again, you know, talking about urban issues and so on and so forth. So, I mean, definitely I had that, you know, interest. But I really felt, for me, journalism was a path to being able to express that. And all the work I've done in journalism has been kind of my own way of approaching it. Mm-hmm. So I used to do editorials for WNBC in New York, which was great. And then I had produced a show in New York called Positively Black, and I went to 2020 and was the associate producer there. And then when I got to Los Angeles, I could stop working with my, you know, I had children and stopped working as a full-time parent. And then I did a national talk show with Pastor James Lawson, who is an awesome civil rights leader. And then I, before I started working on this film, I was a reporter, a community reporter for NBC Los Angeles. And so I did a lot of these same kind of stories about, you know, the unsung heroes, people in the community, various communities, and that was a wonderful opportunity as well.
Yeah, sounds like that particular, you know, the unsung heroes, that seems that that was just preparation for this major work here, The Power Broker with Fight for Civil Rights.
Exactly. I wasn't, you know, hadn't even thought of in those terms at that time, but absolutely, that, you know, he was a big unsung hero sitting right there in the living room, so to speak. Mm-hmm. With me. So it became appropriate for me to think about lifting up his ideas at this time, because, you know, it does frustrate me that we still deal with some of the same issues of war and poverty and, you know, the disparity between people. And I know, like everybody knows, that we can do better. We can do better as a society. And we have to. And we have to find ways to encourage ourselves and to give us examples of how to approach things. And I think Whitney Young's story does that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, you know, you're right that Whitney Young saw that the resolution-focused approach to social work was the key to truly creating a society where minorities would have power and status equal to that of white Americans. And this would require that African Americans have, or minorities have, access to the same pillars of the American dream: jobs, healthcare, education, and housing. And you're right. It's like, but still the issue.
Still the issue. And I think, you know, we have to be creative about, you know, approaching it. We have to have dialogue. You know, where there are no points of dialogue, we have to find the common ground. And we have to take responsibility for it. We can't, you know, give this responsibility to others to do. I think that's where we fall down a lot and think that others will do it. I think we have to do it. And we, meaning wherever we are, in whatever situation we happen to be in, whether we're a teacher in a school or, you know, an office worker in a corporation or just a member of a physical community. You know, what are we doing to make things better? What are we doing to make things safer? And coming together, people of like mind. And not waiting for representatives to do it or, you know, our surrogates to do it, but for us to do it ourselves, because it transforms us when we're involved in the process. I mean, not only because it's a good thing to do, but it's because it's a transformative, healthy thing to do for us, too.
Yeah. Well, I know we've went over the time, but I wanted to mention to our audience that you have a wonderful website, WhitneyYoungFilm.com, where there's, you know, really a lot of great information, particularly the section called Legacy in Action, as well as, you know, the bios for the some of the folks that are, you know, sort of real key to the film, like yourself and the narrator, Afri Woodard. It's like, oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
It's like, how did you do that?
I know. Well, I really appreciate the time, and I definitely want to encourage people to see it. I always know when people have actually seen the film as opposed to say they've seen the film, because when they see it, they go, oh, my gosh, you know, there's always a reaction. I didn't know that. I learned so much, you know. And I think, and, you know, for me, I learned an awful lot as well doing this. So I think it's, you know, the reaction has been one of excitement and, you know, discovery, and I want to share that with as many people as possible.
Yeah, we're really happy that, you know, you unwrapped that elephant in your living room for us. Because, I mean, I know, you know, your uncle is really important because I have the stamp and I've got the button from the stamp and I know his name, but I didn't know why he was important. I just knew, like, he was our hero, but, you know, without any details.
Right, exactly. Well, that's exactly why I did, because most people, you know, have the same story. And and once they see it, then also they understand the relevance of that story to today. So that's what's really important as well.
Right, yeah. And then I really, really like the interview with Nanny Jeter. That is just so wonderful. And then Charles Ogletree, who's here, I think, at I guess he's not here, but, I mean, I've seen him interviewed as an expert a lot, and he's always so succinct and just great about talking about sort of the legal aspects of the day and how that fits in with the tapestry of this African American experience.
Exactly. Well, it's a lot to share with people. You know, it's a legacy for all Americans, I think, and you know, we have to you know, make ourselves avail ourselves of the stories from many different people and many different cultures, because, you know, we are working this democracy together with others.
Oh, yeah, certainly.
Yeah.
And then, you know, in your Legacy in Action, you have this list of different programs, because, you know, we're about creating institutions, and so there are a lot of institutions that have your uncle's name connected to them, like the Whitney M. Young Junior Job Corps Center. And where is that at? Is that in D.C.?
No, that's in Kentucky. It's actually at the same school where he was born. Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah. And then he was the president of the National Association of Social Workers, I guess, from 1969 to 1971. And they still honor, you know, him as a social worker.
Exactly. Yes, they were. I've had a lot of, you know, good times going through this process of making a film, and the National Association of Social Workers has been very supportive and really thrilling for me seeing the response of social workers to this film, because, you know, they have really embraced it, you know, him as one of their own, and that's great, because, you know, people who work with the poor a lot of times don't get the kind of respect that they are really due and admiration that they're due. And I think, you know, it was empowering for them to see how a social worker could have this kind of influence on public policy. Good all the way around.
And then there's the Albany Health Center, the Whitney M. Young Junior Health Center, Health Services. Where is that at?
That's in Albany, New York.
Okay, right. And then there's a Whitney M. Young Junior Magnet High School in just
Chicago.
North of the University of Illinois. Is that Chicago?
Yeah, it's in Chicago. It's one of the best recognized schools in the country and definitely in the state of Illinois. School a lot of people want to go to, and we've had fun showing the film to students there as well. Really, so they understand, you know, their namesake and what he accomplished.
Right. And I think it's really cool that at Clark Atlanta University, there's the Whitney M. Young Junior School of Social Work. I think that's really cool.
Exactly. Yeah. So he was a dean there. And so, you know, for them to be able to embrace his name, I think is really excellent as well. Yeah.
And so last question, I hope you have time for it, is I was wondering, you mentioned that an interview that didn't make it into the film because, you know, you had to make it, you know, 53 minutes. Because with commercials, it makes it an hour. And I was wondering about your uncle's sort of relationship with the Pan-African diaspora, because he was traveling in Africa. He drowned in an accident in Africa in 1971, you know, at 49. We mentioned that he died really young. And so I was wondering was that something, you know, sort of looking at the scope of our people globally, particularly those that are part of the African diaspora that ended up where we ended up in the Western Hemisphere and in Western culture because of enslavement.
Yeah, well, he, as he mentioned, he had gone to Africa with, you know, American leaders to meet with African leaders because, you know, he really thought that this was a new day in terms of being able to move forward and work together with Africa. And again, you know, now it's maybe more understood that, you know, this kind of relationship would take place. But at the time, you know, 1971, you know, that wasn't really happening that much. So he was part of a group of people who was moving, you know, into that realm. And I remember reading some letters, you know, that he wrote from Africa and saying that he really was having a great time. He really was enjoying Mother Africa, as he called it. And, you know, found it really exciting to be there. So I think, you know, a lot of his ideas are global ideas and I think can have value and merit, you know, in the diaspora for African Americans, but also the relationship, the multi-ethnic situations that we find ourselves in all parts of the world right now. You know, this is a global society increasingly. And I think, again, this idea of being able to open up dialogue between groups is really critical, as we see in the world today. The problems occur when people separate themselves. But when they're able to open their lives up and have respect, mutual respect, and recognize the inseparability of all life, this is a crucial point. And I think that harping back to the way that Young was raised, the idea of respecting oneself and respecting others is kind of the cornerstone of how to make a peaceful world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the timing of the film couldn't have been more strategic, you know, that the film would be out for the 100th anniversary of the National Urban League, you know, which your uncle was one of its, you know, prominent leaders. So was that, you know, sort of what you were working toward?
I wish I had intentionality. It was just like, okay, we're going to get the next money so we can do the next shoot. It was just like how things worked out. And yes, we are, you know, about to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, which he played a crucial role in as well.
Yes.
So it just kind of has worked out well. Again, it was something that I thought was I would have finished many years previously now, but and it's fine. It's all good. You know, it's all come
yeah.
out
mm-hmm.
really well. So we're happy.
Yeah,
I'm
once you have to go, I know. I just wanted to say, you know, this is really wonderful. And, you know, the serendipity of certain things. I mean, you are certainly, we're being led to do this and your whole team. And it's a really wonderful, wonderful film. And we're looking forward to seeing you in August because you're going to be coming here, right?
Yes, I will be coming again. And my son lives in the Bay Area, so I always motivation. Come up. He's actually involved in a couple of the screenings that are going to be happening in the Bay Area this month. So, but we now visit the Bay Area a lot more than I have before. So.
Right. Okay. Cool. Well, thank you so much. We're gonna. You don't have to stay on for this, but I'm gonna play a clip, the trailer. So, thank you so much for this extended conversation about the film that's going to be airing on ITVS or PBS on February 18th. People should check the listings for the times.
Perfect. Thank
Bye.
You.
You're welcome. Peace yes. and blessings.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You don't get black power by chanting. You get it by doing what the other groups have done. The Irish kept quiet. They didn't shout Irish power or Jew power or Italian power. They kept their mouths shut and took over the police department of New York City. And the mayorship of Boston.
Whitney Young's genius was, he knew how to accomplish what other people were merely for.
I think that Whitney Young was a prophet. I think that he died precisely at a time when few people understood how brilliant his vision for racial transformation of American power was.
He was a figure who was calm, who was purposeful, who was measured.
Whitey Young, I mean Whitney Young, he's the Wall Street of the civil rights movement.
Whitney understood power, and he understood politics. And most of all, he understood people. They said Martin was in the streets and Warren Thurgood were in the courts and Whitney was in the boardroom. One could not have been successful without the other.
That was the trailer for Power, the Power Broker, Whitney Young's fight for civil rights. And we're really happy to speak to the executive, the producer, Mr. Young's niece, Bonnie Boswell, about this great film that's going to be airing this month, Black History Month, 2013, February 18th. And want remember Bob Marley, Nesta Robert Marley, who was born today, February 6, 1945, in Nine Miles, Jamaica. And he made his transition May 11th, 1981. Another friend was also born today, Jamal Ali, and he made his transition in 2011, and after a fight about with cancer, and he was a wonderful poet, and he's a writer, and his Heartfire Rendezvous is still available. It's a great, great love story that's magical realism. So I want to send a shout out to my good friend Jamal Ali and Bob Marley, who is a wonderful, wonderful artist and real visionary, definitely a visionary. And we're going to close the show with a wonderful piece by Billy Harper called Knowledge of Self.
The heir to his big bands was the master of Rod to forever lay out the blue wonderfulness of the orchestra, Duke Ellington, whose greatness transcends all trends. Duke told Max, don't let them call your music jazz, because they can make anything that. What prophecy, cold and true. Why, they can say what your boy, what's his name, Elevated G is playing, is that. You did. But then, what's his name was the king of jazz? And what's the other dude was the king of swing? And we now up to in that alley, banging on them tin pans, they called it swing. But they meant a noun, not a verb. Never could get the verb in it. Remember all them ladies and men, masters and mistresses of the verbal thing at the waters in a blue, new American classical popular song, and Billy, who reached the deepest tear in our heart, and Ella, all flying off them wonderful bands who carried our hearts, our meaning in their songs. The royalty like Duke and the Count of Basie, the lady who made her alliance with the real American president, Mr. Young, and you know they swung. Bean, the Mighty Hawk, taught us all how Lewis sounded on another horn. And the cats in their band, Duke's people at the top of the steeple, Johnny Hodges, Harry Carney, Cootie Williams, Cat Anderson, Paul Gonzales, Ben Webster, and other greats who morphed into another age. If the 20s was the jazz age, then the 30s, the Great Depression. People seemed like they got skinny. But the age of swing, from all those songs, the world was looking for love, but it seemed like there wasn't any. Goose-stepping in Europe, Payne in Spain. They was painting mustaches on the Mona Lisa and putting a commode in a museum. Had civilization stopped? My man Haleem said they couldn't stop bebop, and they won't stop hip-hop. Bird Blue, Dizzy New, Max carried our original earth to this place where we grew. Bud smiled, and here come miles. There was a B and a bop. It's just another B and another app. Where the is and the un-is cohabit the same frame. But the sound was a verb, not a noun, unless you could in Congo style really get down our share shake. But then the could did, and then them original hipsters appeared with the Vance and the Bowie O'Rooney. Said you gotta have them black notes, actually they is blue. I want my fist flatted. And you gotta have the drum where we and the music come from. Dig, that word was the first I heard. It all came beyond paper. For the proper syncopation, you gotta have improvisation. We're gonna take them tired chords and make our own songs, our own stories. Otherwise, it's too dull. It don't swing. It ain't hip. We said we wanted wild, crazy, frantic. We wanted it to be exactly like us. Gone from the square world or out to lunch. My man Symphony Sid from the jazz corner of the world. It sounded like there was never anything before as hip as Birdland and this lullaby where I first heard the divine one. Sassy say, you're not that kind of a boy. You're not that kind of a boy. You're not the kind of a boy for a girl like me. And we heard of Fats Navarro and Fat Girl and Kenny Clark and Klug and Long Tall Dexter Gordon and Stan Getz and Zoot Sims. We heard the hippest people in the world. But remember, when you go out, somebody gonna try to bring you back in. Bop was too hot, the Annie Bop squad say. Too fast, too crazy. Crazy, we said. The counterattack was to bring it back. We'd all been out to lunch too long, whether it was swing or bebop, Disney dream. If you wanted a cop, you had to hit the street. No road out of the jungle, that's 52nd Street. Where the Charleston hit the New York docks, 12th Avenue was a shock. From Angola to the gullahs in South Carolina, got the first thing smoke, went up to New York. Charleston, James P. wrote. Greet those who landed in the devil's northern house. Hell's Kitchen, to be exact. San Juan Hill, Monk and Benny Carter's home, where Lincoln Center sits still. That's right. He on the only money that ain't white. But what we was trying to say, when it got too hot, some folks tipped away from that street. I think it was the heat. Last seen heading west, they next address. It was cool, really cool. Some said, calm down. Miles said, get down. Stan heard, Clute, Budo, Jerry heard, Lee heard, John Lewis heard, Gil Evans heard, Poncho Haygood heard. They gave birth to the school, the real birth of the cool. And the memory of the hip start to slip. The gorgeous blue, the funk we knew. They're gonna bend their knees and raise it back from the mood indigo that flows out of the black. What was bad could be bad. Much, much better than that. Let's spoke that. So when cool started to fool with my man JoJo's soul, he went out and put the church in. Where the Negro's eyes be rolling back in their head and start speaking some stuff ain't never been said. A dude named Buhana played them drums like he was insane. I'm from the blue continent of dark under your heartbeat. Dudes named Horace drug the funky gospel into the joints, hollering, "Let me see what you do with your shovel." And the Holy Ghost popping his tambourine, chick-a-ching, rattling the room. That's nasty when you bring Africa and the Lord in like that. He wanted a messenger from the Holy Ghost Mau Mau Baptist Church, and they got a message from Kenyon 125th Street, the University of Blakey, the Academy of, well, it might have seemed like that, but it really was this. Well, you could dig Hank Mobley and listen nobly to the man who called the uncrowned king, Kenny Dorham, but always so many others came to fill up his space with names of that school, Clifford Brown, Luke Donaldson, Chrissy Hee, Donald Byrd, Jack McLean, Lee Morgan, Benny Golson, all the way to Billy Harper and Wynton Marsalis. What all that was is the saving of the deep historical fonts, the blues, the ancient call and response from across the trees and through the woods, so you know where I am and I wait for your response. Our blue life memory all the way back across the world. The zigzag of chance, the improv, and fix however to the mighty drum, the rhythm of life. What has no beat cannot stay. What was called hard bop was something to wake us up again to the rhythm of ourselves. Max and Brownie, along with Buhana, helped bring the fire back. The post-cool smoke fanned through the wings of the great bird, but now the heavy motion would be by train. We call that band of Miles the Hydrogen Bomb and Switchblade Band, Paul and Red, Cannonball, the Funkus, Mad Philly Joe and Train, the Monster with the Horn. Actually, Miles' great band was but a preface to another awesome being, Trains, Corey Tyner, Jimmy Garrison, Elvin Jones. But Train had to pass through the sphere of Thelonious to get deep into the mysterioso of the funk, leaving the world of the merely hip for the monkishly profound. Monk and Train at the Five Spot opens a new world of other than where you've been. Let me tell you, I was there. Train didn't even know the arrangements. He sounded like a stranger. But in a minute, Train was in it, and the whole building moved and pulled away. Little Rudy Tootie jackying in Monk's moves. So around midnight, the new music came. We never was the same. By the time they got from the Bowery to Carnegie Hall, must have been time for something next stop new. Even a Pharaoh, an Ornette, an Albert, a Sun Ra fell by. They heard Train's cry. Monk's blue inside. A new world welcomed those with ears to hear.
Ah, that was Billy Harper's. And the voice you heard was, of course, Mary Baraka. And I want to make a couple of announcements. Want to let folks know there's a whole lot of great, great writers coming through the Marcus Bookstore, and I have some more details on Friday's show. But I want to let folks know about the Mbutu Award, Shared Humanity, and those awards given by Priority Africa Network are going to be happening on Saturday, February 16th at the Terrace Room at the Lake Merritt Hotel. That's 1800 Madison Street in Oakland, California. And the program, it's the 10th anniversary of Priority Africa Network and the 3rd anniversary of the Mbutu Awards dinner and ceremony. It's always just really fun. And it's from 5:30 to 8:30. The keynote is going to be Dr. Amina Mama, Nigerian author and professor and human rights advocate. And the music is going to be by Fali Chachao from Ivory Coast or Cote d'Ivoire. And the MC is Oakland's Gregory Hodge, Minister Hodge. And the honorees this year are Malanga Kaskalor Center for the Arts, Emmanuel Nadeau, KALW Radio and Echoes of Africa, Eritrean Youth for Change, and Dr. Siri Brown at Merritt College. For information, you can visit priorityafrica.org, and you can call 510-652-1493, and you can also email info at priorityafrica.org. And Mbutu is a word that means the essence of being human. So that's in a couple of weeks. And this weekend, Raw Talent presents Tease Harmony, a spoken word theater piece by Richmond Youth. And that's Saturday, February 9th from 6 to 9 p.m. at El Cerrito High School Theater, 540 Ashby Avenue in El Cerrito. And the keynote speaker is going to be Luis J. Rodriguez, the author, poet, humanitarian, who is known for his book, Always Running, La Vida Loca, Gang Days in L.A. And you can buy tickets at Well, that was a really wonderful play, and so you should look for it if you missed it last week, because they're going to try to remount it. Heard it was really successful. I think it's pronounced Tay's Harmony by Raw Talon. And I want to mention the Marcus Books, one of the Marcus Books signings this weekend is An Unlikely Warrior, Herman Ferguson, Evolution of a Black Nationalist Revolutionary. And that's Sunday, February 17th, this Sunday, 4 to 6 p.m. at Marcus Books in Oakland, 3900 Martin Luther King Jr. Way in Oakland. The phone number there is 510-652-2344, 510-652-2344. Baba Herman Ferguson was one of the founding members of Malcolm X's Organization of Afro-American Unity. He also helped to organize the Republic of New Africa and was a member of the Revolutionary Action Movement, or RAM. As a member of RAM, Herman was arrested for conspiracy. As a result, Herman was sentenced to 3.5 to 7 years, but he fled the country and surfaced in Guyana, where he lived and worked for the next 19 years. In 1989, he returned to the United States, where he was promptly arrested and imprisoned for 7 years. Since his release, he has served as a co-chair of the Jericho Movement and as chair of the Malcolm X Commemoration Committee. He's 92 years young, and his autobiography is entitled An Unlikely Warrior. So definitely want to check that out. Again, the San Francisco Silent Film Festival is presenting Silent Winter at the Castro Theater beginning at 10. And if you missed that interview with Anita Manga, the director of the Silent Film Festival, definitely you want to check out the archives for the Wednesday show this past Wednesday, February 13th. I also want to mention that there's been an extension of the Prescott Joseph exhibit that was mounted for the holidays through the 22nd, and the hours at the Prescott Joseph Center, 920 Peralta Street in Oakland off of 10th Street. The hours are 9:30 to 4:30, and by appointment Monday through Friday. And the phone number there is 510-238-5651, 510-238-5651. And that's all for now, and don't miss the tribute to Belva Davis, wonderful journalist and pioneer, next weekend at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. And you can catch us again on Wednesday and on Friday, the last week of this very busy Black History Month. And I think we're going to close out with one of Mama Charlotte's pieces that we didn't get a chance to play earlier. But, hey, what the heck? Let's play one now. Let me find one. I really like the one that's titled I'm a Free Woman or something like that. I'll tell you in a minute what the title is. Okay, it's called Mama is Free. Peace and blessings.
You know, there's something about getting older that makes me feel kind of free.
Yeah, I feel free.
And I feel so blessed to look deep into my mirror and love the eyes that stare back at me.